this show off, huh? All right. Give me a quick break here. It is June 7th, 2025. Thank you for joining us at The Journey. Project JFK presents The Journey monthly meeting. It's been a little while since we've been on. Been hitting the books, graduating, and hey, I'm still continuing school, but at least the graduation's done, and I can concentrate a little bit more on some JFK stuff. We're
going to
have, what's that, Brian?
Did you get a job yet?
No, I have not gotten a job yet, but I am looking, so.
Keep plugging away, man.
Yeah, that's kind of the little problem. It's like you get the degree, and then the next thing you know, it's like, hey, got to get that job, and you're putting in applications. The only unfortunate part about it is you're dealing with everybody else out there in the workforce, plus the people that are just looking for summer jobs. Well, I'm looking for a full-time job. We're going to have David Ditton joining us here soon. We're going to be talking about the upcoming conference and some details on that. He's also been working on some documents, so we're going to have him discuss and share that with us. He wrote a hell of an article that is going to be in a few publications and websites. I'm going to have Larry Rivera as a special guest today. He's going to be talking about something that's, I think, groundbreaking and informational. We just... what was it, Larry? We did the JFK birthday conference. What was that, a week ago?
Yeah.
With Lori and Fenton?
Yeah.
Memorial Day,
JFK birthday, all wrapped into one.
Right, absolutely. I was the leadoff man during that conference. But, yeah, it turned out really good, and a lot of good information was shared.
Yeah, you started, and I finished.
That's right. Hey, you know, I was the opener, you were the closer. And then, of course, we're going to ask Larry and Pat, what's going on with the JFK documents to see, you know, what new information is out there. But before we get started with that, I want to say welcome again. And let me do a quick share screen here for those of you that, and of course, the share screen is not working at the moment. For those of you that have never been to our meeting, or you're watching this on YouTube or our website, you can go to projectjfk.com, where you're going to find the homepage here. I want to say this happened during our break, but let me show you here. We are now the proud owner of the JFK Assassination Index. This website has been around since 2016, actually. This was a vision started by Don Ratliff. It was the creation of the JFK Assassination Index. It's now under the umbrella of Project JFK CSI Dallas. I will continue to make the website available to all who want to research and enjoy with new additions of information. There hasn't been any updates recently. I think Don said it's been a little while. I don't know, remember how much time it had been, but if you've never been to it or... it's been a while. You can go back and keep checking up on that. You can easily get to it by either going to jfkindex.com or just hitting the button that will take you there. I've got some big plans for this website. We're going to basically use this as a repository for research that, not saying that it's not important, it is. It's just there's only so much room you can put on a website. And projectjfk.com is our main page, which covers our videos, the works of Larry Rivera, J. Gary Shaw. There's going to be some more information that will interact with both websites. But, yeah, there's right now 15 pages that were the originals, and we're going to be adding in more pages as the time goes by. The Dick Russell collection that me and Brian worked on, getting the information digitized, that's where this is going to go. So, yeah, the unfortunate part is Baylor University has, a month ago when I checked, they still not put up the collection. So now that we have this new website connected, well, old website but new to us, and, you know, mastering it and web hosting it, we're going to be putting the information on that website. There was, I think, 20, 30 boxes of information that was digitized, but it's time to get that up there online. You could also, while you're on the homepage, if you feel like hitting the donate button, you can always donate, get your name up on the wall, become one of our supporters. And again, let's go over here to our event section. I'm just going to tap on this real quick. You will find the details of our jury meeting, when those are going to be coming up, next one announced for that. And then we're going to be putting up the information as far as the conference in Dallas. And let me just pull this up real quick, because I'm going to take you to that site next. You can go to jfkhistorical.com, and this website here is the one that is ran by the JFK Historical Group, David Denton. I help out with it as well. The Dallas November Conference is called History Declassified, Pursuing Truth and Justice in the Murder of President John F. Kennedy. Because there is no statute of limitations on justice and truth, it's never too late for justice, and it's never too late for the truth. It's going to be held November 20th through the 23rd, 2025, at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel Market Center, the same place we've been having the conference in Dallas the last 3 years. You can click on the purchase ticket button, and if you want to go ahead and register for your hotel, you can click on that that link, and it will give you the price of the hotel rooms this year. The price for the hotel is $124.44 each night. So that way you can get in on the discounted rate. We're putting up the event details. I'm going to have David come in and talk about this, but we've got a hell of a lineup for speakers. We're almost full and ready to post the speakers, and also hopefully there won't be so many TBAs of their announcements of what their presentation is going to be. To purchase tickets, it'll be done through Eventbrite. And you can select your tickets here. The conference registration plus two meals is $209.92. The banquet for the conference is $65.53. If you want to get the all-inclusive package, which includes the two meals and the banquet, it's $267.67. And Zoom this year is going to be $65.53. This price here includes all of your taxes and fees that, you know, they've got to throw on. So, with that, I think David is probably, let's see if he's in the room yet. He's running a little late, but hey, let's go ahead and kick off. I want to turn it over now to Larry and Patrick McCarthy. What's going on, guys, with the JFK case, the documents? Give us some information on what... I know a lot of us know what's going on. We pay attention. But, hey, the audience may not know exactly the ins and outs of what's going on with the documents, how many are still being withheld. Are we running into issues with NARA? How's that going with it?
Larry? All right. Well, the lawsuit's still going on. We have a status conference with the court. We're hoping that, in light of the president's executive order, there may be a way forward to settle this in a reasonable way. That's that. By the way, for those of you who are curious, I took a look at the executive orders. All of them were auto-penned. So what I don't know is whether – so long as the person that is – the president can delegate to somebody – to auto-pen his name. Just curious whether, the NSC or CIA auto-penned his name without him knowing about it. I don't know. I'd like to find out. But so that's the litigation. As far as the records are concerned, we've had so you have two different levels. You have what the administration's doing and what you have Congress is doing. So on the administration level, they've released most of the records that were in the collection. there are still some records that have redactions. Perhaps the most significant document that was released in full was the Schlesinger memo, which had been from June of 61, when President Kennedy had asked Arthur Schlesinger Jr. to provide recommendations for reorganizing the CIA, and there were two pages that were completely blacked out for 60-plus years, and they finally unredacted them. And the information that was being withheld was that Schlesinger had discovered that 47% of the people working in our embassies were actually CIA. And that actually they probably had better relationships with the foreign countries than our own State Department. So that was sort of, you know, I think people suspected there were some CIA people in our embassies, but that number was surprising. We also saw some, you know, tension between the FBI and the CIA. Apparently, the FBI wasn't aware that the CIA was bugging the Mexican City embassy, our Mexican City embassy. Apparently, Bacon's office was bugged by somebody. So, you know, these are things that are more interesting from a historical standpoint. Not really a lot of stuff on the assassination itself, but the problem is that the records that are not in the collection, we have really not made any progress on getting them. Gabbard has been is the point person in the administration for at least the national intelligence records. Bondi is the point person for records within the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice. The documents I'm looking for are a combination of both those different categories. So, for example, the Marcello recordings that were sealed and the Walter Sheridan files that NBC has, that would be something Department of Justice has to get hold of. The Donald Heath, the records mentioned by Donald Heath in his memo from 1977 about the investigation that the CIA did the weekend of the assassination and a few months afterwards about, you know, down in Miami. And also the Joe Nides files. Those are something that the Gabbard, that would be in her jurisdiction. Now, interestingly, at the last hearing that Congress had, Representative Luna indicated that they were having problems finding the Joannides file. And we know it existed. And we know there should have been at least a litigation hold on that. And then, because Jeff Morley had sued for that. If those records are destroyed, I'm going to really try to push try to get Congress to appoint a special prosecutor. Because they can't be destroying records like this. I mean, they did it in the past. At some point, someone's got to pay for this. And Congress can appoint a special prosecutor. So we'll be interested to see. Luna says, so the other, aside from the administration complying with the executive order, we have a whole separate branch of government, Congress, who appointed a task force. And Representative Paulina Luna from Florida is chairing that. They've had two hearings, which I'm sure everyone here has seen. The first one was it was Jeff Morley, Oliver Stone, and Jim DiGenio, and some Democratic person that was trying to make hay of the fact that Secret Service Social Security numbers were released. The second hearing a few weeks ago was actually more important because it had fact witnesses, and Dr. Don Curtis testified along with Judge Tunheim and Doug Horn, and then they had this tool from the Democratic Party, Alexa Cole, who just dropped an article on MSNBC this week that was completely insulting to the research community. And I would urge anyone listening to go on her X page and criticize her for what she wrote, because she basically said there's nothing new, that all our views were crystallized like volcanic glass, that we don't know anything about archival records. I mean, just complete nonsense.
Nothing to see here, folks.
Yes, right. Now, for those, just one person I want to clarify a little bit about is Dr. Curtis, because he spoke at the Kappa conference in 2018, and I've had numerous conversations with him over the years. I wanted to write an article about him. He would not let me, because he wanted his testimony to be given to Congress. He's a very modest man. He's not looking for any publicity. And I did an article after he testified, that's at the JFK Facts Substack. He had two really important things to say. One was that Dr. Kemp Clark, when he stopped the efforts to save the president's life, he pulled up the president's head and showed each of the senior doctors who were not treating the president, but were there in the room. He called them over to look at the back of the head wound to understand why he stopped the treatment. So this is him reaching out to his colleagues, not the young treating doctors that were, you know, trying to save the president's life, but these are the senior doctors. So they all got a good look at the back of the head. Now, the Warren Commission didn't interview non-treating senior doctors. So no one ever got asked the question, did Dr. Kemp show you the wound? Dr. Clark, I mean. So there's no corroborating of that. But you have to take Dr. Curtis, you have to watch Dr. Curtis and say, does he seem like, you know, is he a credible witness? And the other thing he testified about was how Harlan Specter tried to intimidate him to say that there was that the wound in the throat was an exit wound. And what the Warren Commission did was they would have unrecorded preliminary interviews with witnesses before they would go on the record. So, like, for example, with Dr. Curtis, he went into the office of Administrator Price, and Specter sat there with him around a table, and they talked about 20 minutes about, you know, what they were going to talk about. And that gave Specter a chance to find out what Dr. Curtis would say, and then also to try to change his testimony or try to get him to change his testimony. And then they would go into another room where the actual deposition would take place. And in this room, Specter was sitting behind a wooden desk in a leather chair, and Curtis was sitting on a bar stool, which just that dynamic alone is very intimidating. And he asked him 57 questions, and he dodged around the wounds, because Dr. Curtis was adamant that what he saw was an entrance wound, not an exit wound. And there's no record of what their preliminary interview was, except for what Dr. Curtis said. And he's been consistent with that account. When he first went public in 2013, in 2018 at the Kappa, in his conversations with me, and then, of course, in Congress. So that was really important, I thought, because that helped to expose the lie that the Parkland doctors did not have a chance to look at the extent of the wounds of the president in the back of the head.
There's also the appearance of Bolden.
And Abraham Bolden also testified remotely. There was some audio issues the day of the conference, day of the hearing, but now that's been fixed, and you could listen to that as well. Patrick, anything else that you want to add to what?
First of all, regarding the actual documents that have been disclosed, redacted, unredacted, I would defer to RACS. And also regarding the Jeff Morley's efforts on the Joannides matter, that's really his bailiwick. And each of them are experts in those areas. And so they could be more informative concerning what has not been produced, and certainly the Joe Nides file. I mean, the very absence and the extent to which that those files have been protected in and of itself speaks volumes about the desire of certain people to keep those documents secret, in effect.
Yeah.
And that brings me to the issue of separation of powers. There was an interesting article this week in the New York Times, which I can probably copy to anyone who's particularly interested in the article itself. It was about a brief filed by some of the most influential, and I can't overstress influential, right-wing or conservative, if you will, legal scholars in the United States concerning separation of powers and the, you know, the overbearance of the executive branch as regards the judicial branch, but also particularly the legislative branch. And in our litigation that is currently pending still, we have argued and I continue to maintain that separation of powers is a very important concept to keep in mind when you think about classification and overclassification. For example, in our case, with regard to the Kennedy documents, you have the executive branch overclassifying documents, and that would include all the agencies that are within the executive branch, and especially FBI and CIA. And so the executive branch classifies the documents. The Congress passes a very powerful act, the JFK Records Act, and which is unanimously passed by Congress and then signed by the former head of the CIA who was sitting as president at that time. And so it's clearly the will of the Congress and I would argue the people also. And then when we go to the courts, when the act is not complied with, and we say to the courts, we were looking for compliance with the act, the court should not defer to the fig leaf of national security and say, well, it's really something we shouldn't tamper with, which is the national security, you know, sanctum sanctorum, which is reserved for the executive branch. And it's a unitary executive type of argument. So that breach in the legal position of the right side of the aisle, including, by the way, the Federalist Society, who has recommended every judge that Trump has nominated. In other words, he has deferred to the Federalist Society. And now Trump is in a feud with the Federalist Society also, partly as a result of the filing of his brief. And the brief was filed in two different cases. Now, the brief is filed, I should add, regarding allocation of funds and the cessation of funds by DOGE. And so that's the particular legal issue and question. But that same brief is going to be cited over and over and over again. It's an amicus brief, meaning a friend of the court brief, and it's a very significant breach in the right wing's legal scholarship. And it applies to our case because the executive branch should not be able to simply talismanically pronounce documents beyond the ken of the American public for national security reasons. And the reasons why in the JFK case are particularly obvious. And of course, Larry's very knowledgeable about even the power of the Warren Commission, for example, and subsequent committees and commissions to classify documents, even their power to do that, which is not only highly questionable, but doubtful in the extreme. So
I want to add to what you were saying about
records. Please do.
So Mary Farrell put all the records that were released on the website, and they're scans, so you could do them by, you know, the optical scan, so you could search by word. But I want to caution people when you start using this artificial intelligence, there's been instances where it has been hallucinating in our case. And one particular example, which was set me off on a wild goose chase for 3 days, was someone had posted that there was a document released indicating that Sam Giancana had a guy called Sal Russo give Ruby money on Thursday the 21st to kill Oswald, and then on Monday there was some sort of correspondence saying mission accomplished. And I spent 3 days trying to find this alleged document. And what it turned out to be is that Sam Giancana's real name was Salvatore. And there was a Perry Russo in New Orleans that you all, that's the Kevin Bacon character from the movie. And somehow the Grok just combined them into Sam Russo, and there was no memo about documenting any exchange of money. So I just caution people to make sure that if you're going to use one of these tools, that you do your own independent vetting, because just because this software says there's something there, it doesn't mean it's there. Well, plenty of lawyers have been sanctioned because sometimes the artificial intelligence makes up cases. So I just want to caution people to be very careful about using this tool. Now, going forward, as many of you know, I have friends in the West Wing, and I am about to follow up not only on the records that I mentioned, but there are some forensic tests that I want to have done that are really important. Number one, John Orr had gotten the FBI to analyze tissue that was on the fragments that were found in the limo, and the fragment, the head of the bullet that was found in the limo had human tissue on it. This was in the late 90s. The next step was to determine what kind of human tissue it was, which hasn't been done, and also to try to get DNA. The reason being that if the human tissue is neck tissue, that would suggest that could be a bullet from the president, and maybe that would support the single bullet theory. If it's skull or scalp tissue, then that means that those bullets did not represent anything that went through the throat, but may have been from the head. But also, if it's got John Connolly's DNA on it and not John Kennedy's, then that completely eliminates those fragments as being anything to do with the president's killing. So I'm going to ask for the Department of Justice to continue that investigation. The next thing also is when the House Select Assassinations Committee test fired the rifle in 1978, the bullets in 1978 did not match the bullets from 1964. The explanation by the experts was that, oh, that's because the tool marks changed. And we have subsequently learned that guns can be fired thousands of times. Cliff Spiegelman, who was the statistician that testified before at the mock trial, testified to this, that there's been bullets, firearms fired thousands of times, and the tool marks don't significantly change. So while the National Archives did a 3D image of CE-399 several years ago, what they haven't done is taking an image of the rifle barrel. And what we need to do, there is now 3D software that can be used to analyze. We don't need to rely on an FBI subjective expert. We can have software actually compare the bullet fragments to the rifle to see if they actually do match. And I'd like to have those done to try to put this to rest. There's also now 3D fingerprint software. Now, I don't know if the fingerprints that are remaining are sufficient to do that, but this is something that, you know, I think when the fingerprints were collected in 1964, the United States did not have a uniform number of similarities that have to agree before you can declare a positive match. Europe actually required more points than the U.S., but with the 3D friction surface, I think we should ask Congress to, now the task force doesn't have any money, but they could certainly get the FBI to get the NIST to do this. So in addition to trying to refocus the administration on the outstanding records that have not been turned over to NARA, and I'm working through my contact within the West Wing, I'm going to send another letter out, where I'm going to ask them to focus on also on these forensic tests. And if there's any other witnesses that you guys think should be asked, we don't know. We don't think there's going to be another public hearing, but there might be a roundtable hearing. And it looks like Congress is intending to issue a report when this is done. Now, there's a bunch of things that are, you know, they have like seven things they have to look at. I think that the UAP may now be off the table based on the story this week that dropped, which is kind of relevant to the Kennedy assassination. Apparently, the Department of Defense was deliberately spreading falsified images of flying saucers and other stories to try to distract everyone from the secret weapons planning we were doing at Area 51. So they were trying to distract people by coming up. They were actually planting stories. They actually told, there's an article in today's Wall Street Journal about this. This is really interesting. The report that came out in the fall did not reveal this information that just came out in the Wall Street Journal, and it's part one of two parts. But it shows the extent to which the Department of Defense even was spreading disinformation to its own employees so that people would be distracted and also would then share these stories with other people, and it just would take, you know, just sit people in the wrong direction. Can you imagine what they would be doing with the Kennedy assassination? So I encourage everybody, by the way, to read today's Wall Street Journal about the UFOs. But anyway, the task force is supposed to it goes out of business at the end of July. They're going to have to get extended, and they haven't done anything about RFK or MLK yet. Now, a bunch of RFK records were dropped, including autopsy photos, and it was really hard to look at them. And if I was one of Bobby's siblings, I'd be very upset with him right now because I don't think he consulted with them. But anyway, they haven't done anyone MLK, so I'm hoping they're going to be extended. But there's more work to be done. And so if you have any suggestions about witnesses, you know, you can either contact Representative Luna directly, or you can contact Jeff Morley or myself or someone else that has contacts within the committee to try to get them to speak to these people. So I don't know. Yeah, Patrick, go ahead.
Yeah. David, if I can just make one more point here. I don't want to tax our audience's patience here. But with regard to the first hearing by Representative Luna, who deserves a lot of credit, I don't know. I'm thinking that if you haven't, I'm speaking to the audience, if you haven't watched that hearing, I would recommend seeing it. It does have its pitfalls and weak points, but it's worth looking at. And I'd also recommend the testimony also of Hardway, Dan Hardway. The guy's incomparable. But in addition to that, I wanted to point out, by way of example, something as to what we are up against. And when I say we, I'm talking about the kind of people who are on this broadcast here, which are very knowledgeable people. And so here's what happens at the first hearing. Now, here it is, this monumental hearing in and of itself. And Representative, I want to say Brobart, who's the, I would call her ultra-right wing, very, very ultra-conservative, Trump-supporting representative, is on the panel. During this questioning, she walks in and sits down. She appeared completely unprepared and then proved it. She gets a chance to ask a question on this historical occasion, really. And she asks Oliver Stone. Now, Mr. Stone, you wrote a book saying that LBJ did it. I want to know if that's still your opinion. And Stone, meanwhile, I think almost to his credit, is completely befuddled. And he looks over at Jeff Morley, and Morley whispers in his ear, "No, that's Roger Stone, who's a really close associate of Donald Trump." And to my knowledge, it's never even been asked of Roger Stone. He's very public in all his pronouncements, nor of Trump, about the Roger Stone book. And the book, I assume all of you read it. It's LBJ Did It. It's called The Man Who Killed Kennedy or something to that nature. And he pins everything on LBJ. I don't ascribe to that personally. But that's the level of knowledge you're dealing with there. You're talking about Oliver Stone, one of the most famous directors in America, Roger Stone, who's a close associate of the president, and this representative who's on the panel investigating this doesn't know the difference.
Well, the other problem is that in addition to a lack of knowledge on some of the Republican representatives, the Democrats had no interest in this topic at all. Their entire efforts the first day were to try to undermine the task force. They start asking Jim Giorgino about some posts that he wrote about Jackie Robinson being taken down from the Department of Defense website. The Democratic witness was there to focus solely on the fact that Social Security numbers got released, which was a terrible thing that happened. And then the second day, second hearing, I don't know what that witness's purpose was, but Garcia, who's the minority ranking chair of the committee, was trying to get Jeff to say that Oswald killed Kennedy. It just shows you there is no interest on the Democrat side to get to this story. And then there's incredible lack of knowledge on the other side. Now, I granted this is like 60 years ago, and very few people that are on this committee were even born at the time. But it was frustrating. The good thing is that we have testimony given to Congress. That's a good thing, Patrick. But the politicalization of this, it's like it turned 180 degrees. Anything that attacks the deep state or the intelligence community, the Democrats will attack. They were trying to use this as a platform to undermine the president and his agenda, and then you have the Republicans that, you know, the only one that really knew anything besides Luna was the other representative from Tennessee, but he's a little more senior, and I forget his name. Anyway, we'll see what happens. But it was disappointing, the reaction and the response to the representatives. But the good news is that we're getting information on the record that was never put on the record before.
Thank you, Larry, for this opportunity to say something.
Hey, Larry, and Patrick, this is Casey.
Yeah.
I just wanted to personally thank you guys for all the research that you guys have been doing. And when I first got into listening to Representative Luna and opening up of the new possibility of trying to figure out what's going on, I have to tell you, when that whole aspect got mixed up with Roger Stone and Oliver Stone, I'm sitting there going, good God. I said, what a way to start off a meeting about the murder of the President of the United States.
Yeah.
And you get these two guys mixed up. I said, where in the hell have you guys been? I know these guys are younger than me, but I'm sitting there going, are you prepared for this? What is going on? And yeah, I about fell over. I'm sitting there going, well, here we go again. But, I'm open to what Representative Luna is doing for us, and at the same time, I know it's 62 years after the fact, but
Casey, Jeff has told me, Jeff Morley, he was meeting with Luna, and he mentioned about some document, And she turned around and had her counsel call up the National Archives and say, where is this document? So she is a real fireball. And, you know, she will get things done to the extent she can. She wrote a letter to NBC to try to get the Wegman and Darnell film. And apparently the wrong film was sent back. And we obviously need the original so that we can digitize it. But she is a fireball, but she's one person, and she's got a lot on her plate. But if there's anyone that could, you know, get something accomplished, she's really, really motivated to get this done. She was the perfect person to be appointed as chair of this task force.
Well, I want to personally say thank you to Larry and also to Patrick. You guys have done a super job in trying to inform us about what's going on, about, you know, how to interpret what is going on at that level. And I know it's a level that that not all researchers will look at, but it is the base level of how we get things accomplished and done. So thank you guys very much.
And I'll tell you, Gabbert and Ratcliffe, you know, they're trying to – I mean, you know, they're the president's appointees. And the resistance that they're getting – I mean, Gabbert, we talked about, they discovered, like, you know, lockers of records. Even yesterday, Patel was talking, well, the day before was talking to Joe Rogan, and he was mentioning that there were some files that Comey, who was the old attorney general? Anyway, that, you know, they discovered that were, like, locked away. So there's so much compartmentalization and siloing in these agencies. It takes an effort to find these documents.
That's interview when he said Comey not only had records, he had a whole secret room where he had documents stored. So it was a whole room in the FBI that nobody had ever seen before, which seems unreal, but that's what he talked about.
You know, there could be documents out there that are squirreled away, and that turned out to be true of the Dallas Police Department.
Right, right. And look, even Bill Kelly, what he discovered some Secret Service documents under someone's bed. I mean, there's, you know, but it's taking time, and, you know, that's why we have to keep, I mean, I'm friendly with Roger Stone, and he knows certain people, too, and so I'm pulling all the levers to try to keep the pressure on. The media obviously moves on, but we have to keep the pressure on between our contact in the administration and then Luna. So long as Luna's task force is in effect, she can continue to put pressure on, so... again, just a call out if you have witnesses or documents that, you know, haven't been released, that may not be in the collection, let us know so we can point them out to Luna so she can ask. She calls them right there and says, I need these documents.
Well, guys, I want to say thanks again for giving us the update. Another thing, when it comes to AI, unfortunately, you what's the old saying? You can't believe everything that you read. And when it comes to AI, it can definitely throw a few wrenches in the works there to actually get the information that you're looking for. That's one of the reasons why they always say no use to ChatGPT or AI when you're doing studies. I learned that firsthand while doing the degree the last couple years. But, maybe the representative got her information from AI when she confused Stone and Stone. By the way,
did anyone see Bill Maher's Club Random interview with David Mamet? There's an update on the movie. It's not a good update, but what he said afterwards was interesting. Mamet said, first of all, I guess there was, you know, he was involved in a movie that they were going to be making. It was the Giacana grandchildren or something were writing the script. They had John Travolta, Pacino, some other bunch. They had some interesting actors signed up. Apparently, it died because of the legal fights. But he said a couple of interesting things I've never heard about. Number one. He said that Marcello had an affair with Oswald's mother. I think you may be wrong in that, maybe misremembering. So maybe it's her sister or something. Obviously, the sister's was married to a guy that was a runner, so there's something there. But he also said that he did not believe the Zapruder film was intact because he said, from a film person's standpoint, that you can't have a film that's going 18 frames per second and having like the explosion in the head and this disappears immediately in the next frame. That it's got to be something where it's diminishing. But anyway, it's on YouTube now. It's about 8 minutes long. If you watch the entire Club Random, it's around minute 38. But there is now excerpts on YouTube where you can see where Bill Maher and David Mamet talk about the assassination film. Okay.
I appreciate that. Definitely check out the information that was shared by Patrick and Larry, and keep an eye out on any more future information that may be in front of Congress, the committees. Speaking of documents, I want to turn to David Denton. First, we're gonna go. I gave a little rundown on the conference coming up here in November. David, do you have a? I know we don't have a schedule put up yet, but do you have a list of speakers that you'd like to at least kind of soft launch into who's going to be there and who's going to be speaking, and then we're going to go into your work that with the article that you wrote.
Well, I don't have the full list in front of me, Dave, but just from memory, I'll try to mention, and if I forget some people, forgive me. The list is ongoing, obviously. We're still in the process of recruiting people and analyzing who we can get and how many folks. We're going to have a full schedule. There's no question about that. We're actually expanding our schedule this November. Last year, I think Dave and I started things at 2:00 on Thursday. And this time we're probably going to start a few hours sooner just to add more people. There's more interest. Obviously, our focus is on new material, new documents that have been released. And in fact, one of the highlights, I think, and I've asked Larry to be to be there for that perspective. We're wanting to do a panel discussion about some of the very same things we've been talking about here for a while. I think that'll be a highlight of what we're doing. As far as individuals, of course, Dave Knight, excellent researcher who's running this meeting, Casey Quinlan. I'm seeing some folks that were definitely Brian Edwards, Mal Hyman, a professor from South Carolina, does a great job for us. Lion Jones, always looking at the MLK information. Got a new author, Mark Harris, who's written something for Chris Milligan, is interested about the extremist groups, the Southern Freemasons, and their potential connections in Dallas. Walter Herbst, a recent author, who's going to bring us some good material. The excellent investigative reporter from California, Dick Russell, has a new book coming out. I just had communication with him. I'm pretty certain he is on board. It'll be an excellent schedule. There'll be more names, obviously, as we go forward.
And we can't forget Ed Tatro, too. So.
Yes. my friend Ed Tatro, the excellent researcher from Massachusetts, who's always entertaining and always got something new. And, again, our focus is, you know, we have some speakers that we've had before, including ourselves, but we put a big emphasis on the idea that let's bring something new to our audience. This is the time. The new document release is part of it, but there are also things coming out every day. I know it gets harder for a topic that's 61 years old to necessarily, you know, bring a whole new examination to something. But oftentimes, you know, what I try to do as a researcher is I may return to some of the things I talked about before, but I try to reinforce it with new material, maybe new twists on the same topic, a little deeper research. And so I think folks, whether they join us on live, which we'd love to see everybody there, again, I think the dates on it are November 20 through 23, you know, or we will be having a Zoom opportunity for that as well for the folks that can't make it to Dallas. But we're excited about it. It should be a great event. Looking forward to it.
Well, so, Dave, let's switch gears a little bit to this article that you've written. I had the opportunity to read a draft of that and go into some of the I'm just a teaser, if nothing else. What you found in your research in what you wrote in the article, and yeah, where that article is going to be posted at?
Yeah, it's, I've been working with Jefferson Morley, and I'm hopeful that's going to be published in JFK Facts here. I've turned it in recently, and we've gone back and forth. He's shown some interest in some of the things I put up on social media. And the article is about primarily about the president's foreign advisory board that was set up post Bay of Pigs, and it's clear what that advisory board, foreign intelligence advisory board, their mission was to scrutinize the CIA in every fashion possible post Bay of Pigs. And so I think some of you are probably familiar, most of you probably familiar with, you know, when the new documents were released, one of the significant documents was that was anticipated. I know a lot of people were looking forward to seeing it, Jim DiEugenio, the Schlesinger memo from 1961. And once that document was released, it certainly raised some eyebrows here this spring, which was basically an analysis of the excessive power of the CIA that Schlesinger was writing about in 1961. And, you know, he described it as an out-of-control state within a state. And you guys were familiar with some of those things. I mean, they were eye-opening. I recall that memo, for instance, that it mentions that 47% of State Department officials across the world were actually CIA. That the State Department had, in effect, been co-opted by the CIA. There were 128 CIA agents, I think their number is correct, in the Paris embassy alone, which was, you know, Paris is not exact, France not exactly a threat to the United States at that time. It just showed you the degree of power and influence, and I think the Schlesinger memo emphasized that, and I think the documents that I've come across, and I'll show you a few of them, that are all connected to this advisory board that Jay and some of his most trusted advisors were put on that board, were looking at reining in, reforming, or even, I'll make an argument before I'm finished today, you know, even going farther than that in terms of the power of the CIA. So, Dave, if you can help me out now, can you see on my, the screen here? I do have some two or three documents here on my thing. Are you just seeing me or?
We're just seeing you at the moment. Make sure you hit the share screen and then click on that window that you want to share with the document.
Okay. Now
there, you'll see at the, it'll probably be at the bottom. It'll say share.
Yeah, I just hit that.
Give me just a quick, hold on just a second.
I've got multiple screens here. That's my problem.
Hold on. Okay, go ahead and see if you got a share button on your screen now. On your Zoom window.
Yeah. No, that's not it. It's okay. screen I'm sharing, and I don't think that's the one I want you to see here.
All right, now we've got something on the screen, so go ahead and pick which one you want to show there.
You got it now.
Did you see a document?
Yeah, this one's got page 7.
Yes, sure. Got it. Good. Okay. Great. Well, we're rolling in. So you see where I've highlighted, right, folks? Can you see that at the bottom?
Yeah, we see that.
Yeah, all right. So these meetings start to happen. It's obvious what the spark of this all this was, and that was the Bay of Pigs. And, of course, we can talk about the Bay of Pigs a little bit, and everybody gets familiar with that. But I think this advisory board came as a result of the Bay of Pigs debacle. The timing is you know, not just coincidental. So, and they met multiple times over about a 3-year period. In fact, there was a meeting of this same board the day JFK died. There were meetings of this board, and I'll mention those after his death as well. And the folks that were there, and again, important, I don't want to spend too much time talking about all of the individuals. I kind of do that more in the article and take a deeper dive into who some of these folks were. But JFK made appearances in this meeting on more than one occasion. In the May 1961 meeting, which I have right here, JFK flatly comes into this meeting. You can see it right in front of you, and makes this statement in terms of covert action, that covert action programs of the CIA may not have been worth the risk nor the great expenditures. He is bluntly telling this to me. I don't think the CIA should have covert action ability anymore. Again, this narrative of how what JFK wanted in terms of pushing back at the CIA post-Bay of Pigs. Then he says further on here, if you notice that, he said, which is a very telling statement, the president indicated that except for Laos and Cuba, he did not have extensive knowledge of other covert actions being conducted by the CIA around the world. In other words, JFK saying, I'm in the dark. I don't know what these guys are doing. That's how I read this. Not, you know, I know about Laos and Cuba. What else are they doing all over the world? So there's that concern that these people that we saw in the Schlesinger memo, we're seeing here with this advisory board of an out-of-control agency that needs to be reined in. And it becomes apparent early on. And I talk in the article a little bit about the fact that that, you know, in the Bay of Pigs situation, that David Talbot's book makes a good argument. I think there's some documents that reinforce the idea that the Bay of Pigs was a setup, that the Bay of Pigs was designed for failure, that to draw JFK into a all-out invasion of Cuba. And whether or not Kennedy fully understood that or not, I don't know. But I think he understood that he had been, in some ways, duped, pulled in, deceived, and he wanted to do something about it. I mean, that's primarily the focus, I think, of these, especially early on with these documents in 1961, real discussions. Another interesting thing that came out of the documents, in fact, I think it's, if I'll try to move this down a little bit, is in this same May 1961 meeting, Alan Dulles kind of shows up. I think it's mentioned here. Yeah. You know, again, Dulles is in trouble. Let's put that into context. It's right after the Bay of Pigs. His head's on the block. We know that. Obviously, he is fired. It's interesting that even Dulles makes a statement in this meeting that, well, maybe we shouldn't have, speaking of the CIA, power to do paramilitary operations anymore. I thought that was significant. Now, Dulles didn't say we're willing to give up covert operations in general, but he's the big paramilitary operation, which, of course, the Bay of Pigs was. Maybe that's too much for us. My impression, and this is probably more speculation than anything, I kind of feel like that Dulles is trying to hold on to his job. I think he's trying to say, okay, well, maybe we'll give this up. It didn't help. Obviously, Dulles is going to get fired anyway. But it's not coincidental. Not long after Dulles makes this statement, of course, we're all familiar with the movie JFK, and it's brought up prominently by Oliver Stone about NSAM 55, right? This document that supposedly JFK released that transferred large-scale covert military, paramilitary actions from the CIA to the military. It's interesting that in this meeting, Dulles says maybe we should do that, and not long, within months, a couple of months, a directive is put out, no more large-scale paramilitary operations for the CIA. And really, there were. That part of was, in effect, taken away from the CIA. And yet, there's going to be a large amount of frustration with the board members who are, again, trusted James Doolittle, who was, of course, the hero of World War II, you know, the Doolittle's raid. He was on this committee. A lot of, Clark Clifford, who's legendary advisor to multiple presidents. So JFK had good people on this board, and they had serious discussions about, and I'm going to finish with hearing a little bit about exactly what they wanted implemented or tried to. But as the time grew on, you know, these met multiple times over about a three-year period. You can tell by 1963, there's a level of frustration on the part of these people about a lack of action of any type of implementation of some of the reforms they were suggesting. In fact, one of the things when I sent this article into Jefferson Morley, I made a comment about one of the people that turns out to be kind of the villain here is John McCone. I mean, you think about McCone as a guy that replaced Dulles, that was maybe handpicked by JFK. But when it came to some of these reforms and desires for changes, McCone is every bit as resistant or maybe more so than Dulles about implementing some of these things. Like, you know, they were asking for reforms of certain whatnot. I'll quote from one of the documents where McCone says, this indicates his belief the board panel acted. He seemed to be concerned with matters which were appropriate for the DCI himself to pursue. In other words, he's saying, you guys are trying to take my job away. You're cutting into my area of responsibility. And over a period of time, I think the frustration by early 1963 with these folks who were trying to implement some of these reforms from the CIA. April of 63, board member Gordon Gray stated, if at today's meeting the board received a full story concerning clandestine covert actions being planned and executed under CIA auspices, this would certainly constitute a milestone. Now, I don't know if you caught that or not, but that was just pure sarcasm. Like this member, board member Gordon Gray saying, if they actually were forthcoming to us and filled us in on what was really going on, that would be a first. And this was after two or three years, okay? So ultimately, and I want to get to, I've got about two or three documents here to show you, so bear with me on this. I've already got that.
Hey, David, if I may for a second just comment on that. That is such an important document. I also found it, and what struck me about the document was how hands-on JFK was with the situation and all the
there's no question about it.
And giving guidance, you know, and I've written and I've referenced this new document in my new book. And I found this to be one of the really, really one important documents out there.
Yeah, and this one, which I have in front of me, I don't know if you've seen this or not.
Oh, by the way, I posted it here on the chat in case anybody wants to access
it. Yeah, I don't know if you're seeing this one, but this is the one that I really, late in the process of writing this article, I actually came across this one, which was January of 1964. I mentioned to you that these meetings were held right up to the death of JFK. In fact, on November 22nd, they were squabbling the Vietnam, or the whole issue about Vietnam and who should be in charge of covert actions there. That was actually a discussion between the military and the CIA. That was a discussion the day of JFK's death. So it was an ongoing thing. But they would meet in January of 1964 with the idea of reviewing or updating the Johnson administration or Johnson himself about what they had done the last two or three years. I really struggled to find, they were talking about this reform and that reform. I didn't have a written list. You know, the documents are kind of sprayed all over the place. You don't have a search engine. And then Jefferson Morley recommended, hey, go on this website and look at that. I forget the name of it. They actually had this one posted. And it's a document that actually goes back and lists 170 recommendations that this advisory board had for reforming or, if you will, reining in the CIA. And the most explosive ones are the ones that came out in 1961, not long after obviously the Bay of Pigs. I mean, right from the get-go, this board was in effect, I think, issuing or at least making recommendations that would, in some ways, many ways, carry out JFK's vision about scattering the CIA into 1,000 pieces. We've all heard that. You know, we've all heard that term before. But these things really that are listed here are would, in effect, carry that out. I mean, so let's take a look in terms of their recommendations. And I can read some of these to you, too. So one of the things is the idea that the DCI would be moved, in other words, the head of the CIA, would be moved to the White House. Now, that has implications. I mean, where you were located, I think there's no accident there, but they wanted to take the head of the CIA and almost hold him hostage. I don't know, maybe that's a blunt way, but, you know, put him under their thumb or control in the White. You will be stationed in the White House. To me, that's how I read that. And then the DCI, again, speaking to the head of the CIA, would give up day-to-day operational responsibility to his second in command. So here again, trying to diminish the power of the head of the CIA by dividing it up amongst him and his second in command. Okay? Now, let's go down here. I hope you guys can see this here. But to me, try to get some down. Bear with me. I'm trying to work a laptop and it's not being very cooperative. Okay. So, here again, these are recommendations early on in 1961. The CIA placed increasing emphasis on the acquisition of hard intelligence and decreased the excessive emphasis on covert action. That they should, in fact, decrease covert actions. And then why not just even take it a step further? Go down to number 11. Consider the feasibility of transferring clandestine operations, covert actions, to another agency. That's pretty much giving up all your power. They're saying, why don't you guys just think about turn it all over to somebody else? Okay? And then the one that struck me the most, I mean, and see if I can get this to come down here. No, I'll just tell you. That one, 16. Why don't you guys consider just changing your name? I was just like, okay, change the name of the CIA. Now, sure, that's symbolic, but think about that a second. That is, in essence, what JFK had in mind when he said, scatter the CIA into thousands, you're almost ceasing to exist, at least in name. If you're asking the CIA to give up covert ops, take away much of the DCI's power, change their name, these are dramatic recommendations that were made in 1961 for reining in the CIA. And, of course, none of them were really implemented. The CIA played stall ball, which is pretty obvious what went on here. That's why I returned back to the, you know, I mentioned this in my article about the growing frustration by 1963 that some of these reforms, and there were 170 in this, as you can see, you can look through all these on that document. Some of them are much more detailed and granular, I would describe. But implementation, very little of that. The CIA just, you know, put up enough resistance where those things never happened. And obviously, JFK was assassinated. So last thing I want to look at, and I think I've got this from June of 64. Which is obviously seven months after JFK is gone. Here we go. So this is the last document I have. Now, there might have been more meetings. There might be more documents. This is an ongoing thing here. But in June of 64, after all these considerations of limiting the power of the CIA, of taking its covert action ability, and by the way, another one of the things that folks were so surprised about was the level of infiltration the CIA had into groups like Radio Free Europe and foundations. Dulles admitted that. He said, you know, we want to give up paramilitary operations, but we have a lot of proprietary operations going on, including utilizing Radio Free Europe. This stunned the committee. Like Clark Clifford said, I was on the board of this meeting, Radio Free Europe, for 3 years. I didn't know the CIA had infiltrated it. Other people were stunned in this meeting by this. So there was a lot of desire to put a damper on everything the CIA was doing around the world. Now, fast forward to June of 64, JFK is gone. The same advisory board that had spent so much time talking about, let's rein in the CIA, let's limit their power, their activity, their covert action and paramilitary operations of capability. Well, they show up for this meeting, and again, you've got some of the top players here that were at the meeting from the CIA. I mean, you only need to look. I think I think Cord Meyer, John McCone, there were two or three of the big players from the CIA that showed up on this meeting and dutifully reported, hey, look at all the operations we got around the world. Check that list out. Can you see that I have highlighted? Covert actions with respect to Cuba, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Panama, Chile, Congo, on and on and on.
Hey, David, who is Murphy in this? Yeah, Mr. Murphy.
That's Robert D. Murphy.
Okay, I now know who that is. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so my closing, you know, and I said this in the article, which seems obvious, is that, you know, that there was a war going on between the CIA and JFK for power post-1961. over who and how much control over covert action and paramilitary operations. And with the death of the JFK, it's pretty obvious. If you look at what was going on 6 months after his death, that the CIA won that war. That's the impression that I get that you can look at when you see these documents from this advisory board. And again, like Larry mentioned, I think they're very important, and I think they deserve a lot of scrutiny. And there's probably, again, more of them out there. I've looked at about, eight or nine documents associated with these advisory board meetings. But again, they're scattered throughout the documents, and it's, you know, there's no search engine. You just got to keep looking, but there's important things to see still that hopefully we'll be digging in more this summer with some of more research. And I look forward to the article getting out and folks get a chance to look at it. So any questions in terms of
what I want to comment on that because I saw this report on TV about Sabato doing this whole thing with students and bringing them together and looking at documents. People who have never seen anything, they have no way of determining where this starts and ends, and then to try to, derive conclusions based on that. That's impossible. You have to have the background. You have to know how the entire puzzle is organized and how you fit those pieces of the puzzle into the proper place.
Yeah, and I said, I was very honest with you. I was working on this article and really got to the very end of that when I came across this, and I was kind of frustrated. I do not have a list. I know these folks were talking about their various reforms that they wanted to implement, and sometimes you kind of alluded to them, but until I got that last document that actually detailed and listed all the reforms suggested for the CIA, that really kind of, put the finishing touches on it. But again, Larry's right. This is an ongoing thing. We've got a lot of ground still to cover. Stuff.
Mr. Nelson, I have a question.
Yeah.
I've spoken to Bill Simpich and Larry Hancock on this issue, certainly more times with Bill than I have Mr. Hancock. And I'm wondering, now that we have this information brought to our attention that most of the covert action capabilities are being transferred either on paper or in a direct legal sense from the CIA sometime, I'm thinking early 1962 to late 1963, from the CIA to the military's apparatus, specifically under the creation of the Defense Intelligence Agency. What do you make of the phenomena? And once again, I stress I brought this to the attention of Bill Simpich, and he's kind of lost in the legal sense. But what do you think of the phenomena that the central cover staff of the agency in this time period was providing military backstops to their covert operatives? And I want to be very specific here with three operatives, James McCord, David Sanchez Morales, and E. Howard Hunt. All three of these men were provided military covers in 1962 and 63. And I'm just wondering, was that a way for the agency to essentially cover their ass after, the president and the attorney general ordered them to, stop with the covert action capabilities? What do you make of that phenomena?
Well, I think there's a lot there. It's a great question, too. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but whether they were trying to move away from it, again, if you look at these documents, maybe more of the big paramilitary operations, but even there, as I mentioned, like, on the day, if you go back and look at these documents, on the day of the assassination, I'll repeat it, I briefly mentioned that this conversation on the advisory board was, there's a conflict going on in Vietnam over who would have covert action. Would it be turned over to the military or paramilitary action? Again, there's two different things there. I think with the paramilitary, yes. Covert action, I think it was more about interconnectivity. I mean, I've done a lot of work, and I think Casey, my man there, is also looking at it. We came across documents about an operation, a group known as AXI, a small counterintelligence military unit which was deeply connected to the CIA. In fact, what was one of the guys, Sam, forget his name, Sam, off the top of my head.
Pale.
Yeah, Sam Pale.
Pale.
Yeah, had a statement saying, I don't even know who I'm working for. If I'm working for, you know, when I was down in Mexico City, I would, I don't know if I'm working for the CIA or the military.
I've seen that statement. Yeah, he's working for something called 4th U.S. Operations Group in Mexico, but seemingly everybody in 4th U.S. Operations Group Command is CIA.
Yeah, I have documents of, you know, some of these Axie people that are liaison between both agencies. Dorothy Matlack, who's I've spoken about a lot, who's a very suspicious character. So my answer would be is that I don't think there were the CIA was attempting to, you know, pass off to the military. I just think they were intertwined, interconnected in operations where they had mutual interests. I think.
Is David available to give me a screen share? Because yes, there is a correlation where the military and the CIA, you know, have a nexus, and the Axie thing is very important that you just mentioned. But if I may, David, because I just want to pull up my organization chart here as it is at this moment, and you will see at the top here. Are we
go ahead, Larry, and switch over to your screen.
Okay, right here. You can see this here. This is, you know, according to all the information that I've been studying here for more than 10 years, how the chart is organized from the top down, you know, in Mexico City. And right here in the middle, you've got, and at the top, right below McComb, you have Helms running DVP, and he's got an assistant. But right here, General Marshall Carter, acting director, in any case that there is a problem with continuity here, this is the military that's in charge, of the CIA. All right? So that's
intriguing. You know, I mean, we've had debates about who's what. You know, one of the big ones in the last few years, I don't even know if I want to bring this one up, but it might start a big argument, the whole question about who was Antonio Viciana? That one, man, like, was Viciana CIA or was he military? Was he both?
If I may, Mr. Denton, one of the documents that I thought was very revealing, and unfortunately I don't have it in front of me, but you know, perhaps I can ask Bill about this one and send it to you when I have the time, was the fact that Viciana in September of 1963 is reporting to Sam Cale. And of all things, he's reporting on the activities of David Attlee Phillips. Now, why the hell would Samuel Cale be tasking Viciana with spying on Attlee Phillips if they're both working in the same office? That I don't understand. Neither does Bill Simpich, and I thought that was a really funny document.
Go ahead and send that document to those guys, and then when you guys get it, send me a copy, okay?
That's very important. I've seen some documents too. I've talked about this, Monty. An interesting one that I came across in recently declassified documents was the number two in command. Obviously, we talk about Viciana. Viciana is Alpha 66, right?
Okay.
So, and was Alpha 66 closer connection to the CIA or to the military? That question. I know this. When Manoyo got himself in trouble with, I think it was Tropicante, didn't pay his bills to the mob or something, the Tropicante put out some kind of a hit.
The contract.
For Manoyo.
$500,000.
Yeah, the J. Edgar Hoover sent a memo not to the CIA. He sent a memo to the United States military saying, hey, your boy Manoyo is in trouble, which tells me here's Alpha 66. They're probably more military, although I think it's nuanced. I think in the case of Viciana, I've seen documents where maybe he's putting up resistance to being connected with the CIA, but I think he still was willing to listen. You want to give us some money, but don't. But we're not interested in being co-opted by the CIA.
I have a special placed in my heart for Gutierrez Menoyo, and I spend
more
more than 150 pages in my new book on him, given that I have a I know his daughter. We happen to share the same birthday, believe it or not, and I have interviewed her extensively for the book. And with all the new documents that have come out on Gutierrez Menoyo, it's clear to me that Alpha 66, you know, Bestiana was the face of the organization, but the nuts and bolts and the motor was Gutierrez Menoyo. He's the one that spent months on end on the Keys in the Bahamas, Andros Island, running little sorties, you know, into Havana Harbor, you know, trying to sabotage Soviet ships and everything. He's the one that spent 22 years in a Castro jail. He's the one that went into Cuba in December of 1964 with three guys, where he was led to believe, and I have found evidence that this was the last resort, the very last hope to try to take Cuba back, and it was on the shoulders of Gutierrez Menoyo. He tried to incite the campesinos, you know, and the people there, that they thought that they were going to revolt. That was the information that was coming out of Cuba. Just send somebody in there, and they were revolt right away, and that's not what happened at all. In fact, they hunted him down. They captured him. They put him on TV. They did a trial on TV with Gutierrez Menoyo, and they asked him flat out, what the hell were you trying to do here coming to Cuba? And he said, well, I'm trying to overthrow the government. You know, so that led to 22 years. He was lucky not to be executed. Okay, and yeah. The story of Gutierrez Menoyo is coming out in the book, and it's stunning, just stunning. You know, because he was if you were to compare the importance of Vesiana and Menoyo, Vesiana was a one, Menoyo was a 10. Okay, so
Monty, I think some of the issue might be who's paying for everything, because we know Kennedy formally cut off the exiles in the 63, but they were still getting funded. Question is, who was paying? Whoever was paying them, that's probably, you know, why you're seeing these weird arrangements.
Well, one of the more disturbing documents that Mr. Simpich brought to my attention, and certainly I brought it to Doug Valentine's attention, if I may go on a slight vignette about funding in 1963, is the fact that General Sylvester Carter told Richard Helms, who in turn told James Jesus Angleton, that there was a huge counterfeiting operation going on in 1963 where Cuban pesos were being counterfeited and then exchanged in French banks, and in turn, American money was being given. And of all people, the head of the Secret Service, James Rowley, blamed a Nazi war criminal by the name of Friedrich Schwenn for doing the counterfeiting operation for some of these anti-Castro Cuban groups. Now, I want to stress, I don't know what to make of that document simply because there is no follow-up document. It just exists by itself. Rowley never followed up. General Carter never followed up. And certainly Richard Helms and James Angleton gave no follow-up reports, or at least no follow-up reports were ever published. So
that might have been Marcello, because I think they, with the counterfeiting, I think when the exiles got cut off, it might have been that Marcello stepped in and, you know, stepping up with the funding, and who knows how they funded that. But I'm just saying that the weird relationships we see in 63 are probably because of either McCone had some slush money somewhere that he was off the books giving these guys, or someone else was paying for it.
Well, apparently Mario Toli was arrested in 1964 for counterfeiting operations for the anti-Castro effort, and I think he spent about, you know, I think it was like 5 or 6 years in federal prison for a counterfeiting operation. So, you know, it's odd how these anti-Castro groups are able to be so sophisticated when it comes to, you know, for example, counterfeiting, you know. But, you know, make no mistake, by 1969, at least 17% of Brigade 2506 had been arrested for narco trafficking. So, yeah. You know.
Hey, I want to point out a point of information. The reason I brought up Murphy, Mr. Murphy, which is Robert Murphy, is because By the fall of 1963, there were two whistleblowers that one was in the United States Air Force, the other one was in the United States Army, and they were at listening posts, CIA listening posts, and they caught traffic of information, and they interpreted it as an attack on the president sometime in November, and they wrote letters to Robert Kennedy and the president. The president and Robert Kennedy never got those letters, but they were intercepted by Robert Murphy. And I don't know what position he had as an ambassador or maybe CIA or whatever his official signature was, but he's the one that intercepted those letters, and they never got to the president or the attorney general. And those letters basically explained that there might be a military coup happening in November, and these letters were sent to the president and to the attorney general.
Guys wear separate, different hats. So even though you're sitting at a desk, you could be wearing different hats.
Oh yeah.
So you have to, again, it's who's paying you when at that point in time when you're sitting at the desk. You know, this is like what happened in corporate America. People wear different hats. They represent different entities. And so if you read a Wall Street Journal article today about the UAPs, you can see the levels of deceit and confusion that they build these structures out. And I don't think people know who they're working for.
I agree.
Hey, Casey, I want to follow up because you brought that up about Murphy. I want to point something out, and I still have that document that you guys can see, I think, in front of you. This June of 1963.
Hey, Dave, hit your share screen again, please.
Okay. We lose it?
I had to turn off long enough for Larry to put his graph, but go ahead and put yours back up on the screen.
I hit share. Now, here we go. I think I got it. We got it?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me be clear here. I mean, Casey, the Murphy that you were mentioning that was chairing his meeting in 1964 was not the chairman of this same board prior to JFK's death. It's interesting that you brought up your suspicions about this, but that's something I'm being enlightened here, because the guy that headed up the board chairman was a Dr. James Killian, former president of MIT, who was had a long history of being a Kennedy advisor. Killian stepped down, and then Murphy is the guy running this meeting by 1964. And instead of questioning all the covert actions the CIA were doing, it's almost like they're celebrating them. in June. Look at everything we're doing here. I mean, it's a complete about face for this advisory board before and after JFK's death. I find that to be not coincidental, let's say, okay? Anyway, I want to interlude with that.
Where did these meetings, were they at the executive office or were they in the Pentagon?
You know, that's a great question, Larry. I'm presuming they were probably somewhere in the executive branch as opposed to the military, because most of the folks on this committee were non-military. I mean, they were from the private sector. Now, Doolittle, who's, I think, retired by then, was an exception to that. But most of them were, frankly, individuals that I think Kennedy respected, that came from different, some of them were experts in technology, academic sorts, but not so much military. So I'm going to guess probably that meetings probably were not in the Pentagon.
But this isn't the board's offices, and I don't know if that means it was in the West Bank.
That I just don't have a great answer for. Do you guys have any other questions about what we brought up here? I appreciate your time. I hope it piqued your interest a little bit.
I had a hypothetical legal question I wanted to ask you, Mr. Denton, real quick.
Well, you might want to ask Larry that one. I'm not a legal guy, but go ahead.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, for anybody listening, hypothetically speaking, if we can prove that any one of our elected officials, going all the way back to the Presidential Blue Ribbon Commission, you know, the Warren Commission, were involved in obstruction of justice, are they accessories after the fact? Just a hypothetical question.
Meaning
if elected officials had destroyed evidence or suppressed evidence, then we could prove it. Are they legally accessories after the fact?
Yes, as far as I'm concerned. Larry, what have you got on that?
I think Arlen Specter might have been engaged in obstruction of justice. But
That's really fascinating.
But I don't know what the statute of limitations is on that. And, you know, what would be the point of bringing a criminal action against someone who's dead? I can't see them wasting enforcement resources. Patrick, do you have any thoughts?
Yes. It's the avenue to go there is obstruction of justice.
Yeah.
Accessories after the fact would have more to do with the commission of the crime and aiding and abetting the crime, either before or after the commission of the crime per se. And by that I mean the shooting. With regard to obstruction of justice,
I see.
The obstruction of justice aspect, though, goes to history and truth in history, which we're all after, which is something different. I wanted to interject also in regards to both Mr. Rivera's comments and also Monty, although all I see is the name Monty. I don't have your full name there. Sorry.
I wasn't able to post my full name. My full name is Robert Ward Montenegro. Montenegro, just like the country.
Okay. Well, the thing I wanted to comment on about Vestiana and who he was working for in Alpha 66 and the relationship between, let's just say the Pentagon and the CIA, you know, which is the tail and which is the dog? Here's my comment. Recently, and to me this is one of the most important developments, at least in the last 6 months, more important than the disclosure of the documents, is John Newman coming out saying that after all his work and research and analysis, with his background and training and so forth, he thinks now that he believes he's leaning toward a coup. And to me, that's an immensely important conclusion and opinion on his part.
If we get to the point, let's play this out. If it turns out some documents have been destroyed and we can somehow convince the Oversight Committee to appoint a special prosecutor, I presume that we could ask them, include that within their, you know, ambit of their assignment, is to find out if anyone engaged in obstruction of justice. I mean, it won't result in anyone going to jail because they're all dead. But, you know, but that would be that obstruction of justice would be, I mean, I'm not sure that's what you were asking for, because are you thinking that people acted outside of their authority? Is that what you're going towards?
Once again, I bring up Mr. Simpich. I've had maybe 10,000 hours of phone calls with him over the past 5 years concerning this issue. And one of the characters that disturbs me to no end in the Gilonides episode is Scott Breckinridge, who was, Office of Security liaison at one point to the House Select Committee. And up and down, you know, we have, you know, no exaggeration, maybe 100-plus documents indicating that Breckinridge was on orders to obstruct the House Select Committee. And I'm wondering, where exactly does the legal responsibility of the agency end and the individual actions of, say, Mr. Gilonides or Breckinridge begin? You know?
Well, so the problem is that, oh boy. So first of all, you know, there's probably an argument that would be made that there was a good faith view that they were protecting secrets and, you know, obviously you're having a problem with separation of powers, but this happens all the time.
Right.
But then a person committing a crime, is he doing it as part of his duties? You know, you can't commit a crime as part of your duties, but look, they definitely were aggressively interfering with an investigation.
Yes, sir.
Whether one makes a good faith argument, whether one can make a good faith argument that they, in good faith, believe that they were protecting national security secrets and that the requests were, you know, maybe not relevant to the assassination in their judgment, but the other risks outweighed. But the act itself says that, you know, secrets can be withheld if the harm to national security outweighs the public interest. So at the end of the day, you know, I can't imagine anybody being criminally culpable for that kind of thing. I mean, destruction of records is a different thing. Did you physically destroy records? Now you're violating the Federal Records Act.
Understood.
But just hindering, I mean, you'd have to really show egregious behavior, and I don't know, you know, I mean, we have a lessons learned memo from the CIA, which I think Breckinridge may have written in 1999, saying, you know, here's lessons
right.
learned from the JFK, from the act, and, you know, we're never going to let this happen again.
Well, you know, if I can just very briefly, when you look at the Joannides file, it's not impossible that their reason for not wanting to release the file whatsoever is that it may show an operation, quote unquote, that's occurring within the United States borders. And that's an operation against the HSCA. And of course, the CIA is banned from operating within the U.S. borders.
Well, Patrick, what happened when we found out that the FBI and the CIA violated the terms of their charter when the Church Committee made those findings? No one went to jail.
Well, there's a lack of political will. And this is
yeah, right. I mean, they reported on it, but that was it. I mean, remember there was that email, those emails back and forth with the Director Colby, I think it was, saying that we need to investigate, determine if certain actions took place that went beyond our charter. Right,
well,
right.
Where did Colby end up again?
Right, I know. But the I think wasn't that the genesis of the family jewels in 73 that they were looking. They were looking to determine if they had gone beyond their charter, and they did. They found that out.
Allow me at this point to interject a plug for Jeff's book, Dance of the Scorpions, which is about that period of time, and Helms and Nixon. Very, very informative book.
Yeah, yeah. But
Jeff Morley.
Again, it came out that the FBI and the CIA were violating, the CIA violated its charter, the FBI was infringing on the rights of citizens, and no one went to jail. That's the problem. How many people, Patrick, who was the guy from the Clinton administration that took some files and went home with them, and then yeah, I think he got it, had to do some public service or something?
I remember the heavyset guy from Atlanta.
Yeah. But anyway, people don't get punished. That's the problem.
Well, there has to be the political will, and that would be a Department of Justice issue.
Right. Now,
if I may interrupt for a moment, I would like to note that when it came to William King Harvey's Staff D operations in Mexico City, you know, according to Jeff Morley's work on Winston Scott, you know, the vast bulk of the LI envoy wiretapping and photographic reconnaissance operations were not CIA officers. You know, they were Mexican intelligence agents working for the DFS. You know, so technically it wasn't even the CIA conducting those operations against the Soviet and Cuban embassy. You know, so there's that weird legal gray loophole. You know, it wasn't the agency doing it. It was Mexican intel, you know.
Right, and actually Jim Johnston has been trying to determine if the Mexican government still has copies of the tapes.
Right.
Because even if the CIA destroyed them, the Mexican government might have them. but again, that was now you're dealing with foreign relations, you know, and we have a deal with Mexico that they would do this, you know, and that's why these records were withheld all those years, because they didn't want the Mexican people to know that their government was cooperating with our government to do this.
Or the fact, if I may interrupt once more, that the fact that Sylvia Duran, when she was under, you know, essentially torture and interrogation, the Mexican government hired a Guatemalan counterintelligence agent to conduct that interrogation. You know, so, you know, once again, you have another country involved in Sylvia Duran's interrogation.
Well, this is why we had our what did they call it? The black, whatever that. Waterboarding was done in Saudi Arabia or something, you know.
Right, right. Those black sites, yeah, yeah.
So it's a dirty world.
Mm.
So I don't know if I answered your question. It's a complicated question, and, you know, I think the best we could do is, you know, if they appointed a special prosecutor, they could expose it like the church committee did.
Understood.
But no one's, you know, I mean, and look, the Secret Service destroyed records in 1995. No one got punished. And then when January 6th happens, they destroyed the emails. No one gets punished. If the Joannides files get destroyed and no one gets punished, then, you know, the law doesn't have no teeth.
Hey, Dave, are you showing a document you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, it was kind of... backtrack a little bit. We were talking about Axie, and I've talked about this before in some of my presentations. I don't know how well you can see it, is that, you know, if you don't think these guys had a similar agenda to the CIA, and here's a document I came across from the 2017 release about Axie's proposals for Cuba, and what to do about Castro. I have highlighted there, remove Castro and other key political leaders by assassination or kidnapping. So here's an agency openly advocating the assassination of Fidel Castro. And by the way, down at the bottom, hey, we need to possibly use some biological weapons, biological warfare on Cuba. So if you don't think this outfit, Axie, was every bit as an extreme operation as this, you know, in terms of their desire to get rid of Kennedy, or excuse me, maybe that, maybe that's a subtle or a Freudian slip there, to get rid of Castro, these guys were every bit as extreme in their outlook, and of course we know that, again, I'll reiterate the interconnectivity between these folks and the CIA, it's all there, in terms of their desires and their activities. I also had, when we were talking about the, quickly, I'm just trying to show a few things here. We talked about Viciana. This was I actually mentioned this in the article too, about, you know, going back at the Bay of Pigs, the fact that this is a report that was actually, I think it was a report to the CIA, or actually the FBI, one of the two. This is an agency by a reporter named Dan Brigham who interviewed Cuban exiles afterwards, and he said that prevailing thoughts among Cuban exiles, I don't know if Larry's still here on this one, but the idea that the Cuban exiles that were interviewed that survived or escaped the operation in the Bay of Pigs basically suggested it was doomed to failure by design.
And they blamed the CIA and Morales specifically.
And not just Morales. Then I found this in a House Select document released in 2007. Now just quickly about Frank Sturgis, who was involved in that operation. He flat out said David Atlee Phillips betrayed us at the Bay of Pigs. I don't know what Sturgis was talking about there, but is it something to the effect that, you know, this whole operation was bogus to begin with, you know, that what it was meant to fail, to force Kennedy into some type of invasion of Cuba? I think there's a strong evidence of that. And maybe that's part of the story about, you know, Kennedy's desire to end the CIA, the level of deception that they were attempting to try to force him into an invasion of Cuba.
There was never any evidence that local Cubans were going to join the revolt just because somebody said, you know, let's do a counter-revolution here, and that's it. It never happened. It was never possible, you know, and that was one of the misconceptions there, David.
Yeah, and obviously, I'm sure most of you read David Talbot's book about Dulles, but, you know, he points out that at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion, I mean, Dulles was MIA. He was in San Juan, Puerto Rico, giving a speech. He was totally disengaged from the whole effort.
That's being very cogently disputed now, that there was a cover story that he was in Puerto Rico.
You think so?
In other words, there's information coming to light that the Puerto Rico story may have been a cover story, and that he was in fact not far from the CIA at the farm within the CIA.
Yeah, and I wouldn't call it misconception. I think it was misinformation or disinformation.
Yeah.
I think the hope was that, you know, this thing would begin to fail, and then the president would then, you know, okay an invasion.
Yeah, I mean, in some respects, you can make that argument if you go back to the same playbook with what happened with the U-2 flights and with Eisenhower, with his desire to end the Cold War, and then all of a sudden, you know, this huge crisis occurs with the Soviet Union when U-2 planes are shot down. And all of a sudden,
it did kill the summit, right?
Yeah, it killed the summit, and it had the same effect. And I think Dulles was I don't know, what do you want to call it? Master manipulator, I mean, in many respects, in terms of...
I think
they got the reaction they were thinking out of Kennedy, obviously. I think that they felt like they could force Kennedy into invading.
Well, you know, he did campaign as a Cold Warrior, so.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, Dulles really thought, those guys thought they had as much a right to determine U.S. foreign policy as a duly elected president.
That's what was at stake, I really believe. I think that's what apparently, it becomes apparent with the documents we've seen. These guys really thought they had primacy, I guess is maybe the best word, over American foreign policy. I mean, that presidents come, presidents go, but we're in charge. I mean, I think that's kind of a...
That's part of what they were, as Schlesinger said, and by the way, my video's not working, that's why I'm on. Schlesinger mm-hmm. said the CIA was a state within a state.
State within a state, right, yeah. I mean,
47% of our employees at the embassies overseas were CIA. Right. That just shows that they just felt that this was in their bailiwick. They knew they were over the covert actions and the intelligence collection. Somehow, they had a third mission, which is to influence foreign policy and make it.
Yeah. And speaking of new documents, and a couple other things I came across I thought were significant that I'm sure you guys are probably familiar with Operation Chaos, which was 68-69. Again, correct me if I'm wrong. Some of you guys might know more about this. You know, we're basically the CIA at the height of the military at the height of the Vietnam War and the protests were kind of given carte blanche to monitor individuals that were, you know, speaking out against the government policy in Vietnam and what amounted to domestic surveillance.
I should note real quick that Chaos had a sister program called MH Order, and the Order operation was fascinating because it specifically targeted on an international level journalists that were speaking out against the Vietnam War. So there was also a program, Sister to Chaos, targeting journalists called Order.
Well, a couple of the things that came out from the new documents released was that, and again, these are not, this is more just for context. I don't think it's revelatory, but the fact that the CIA had their eyes on one Jimmy Hoffa. Hoffa was given a speech, I think in France, to a union over there, labor unions over there. They had their eyes on Hoffa overseas. They had their eyes on Hosea Williams, who was a close insider to Martin Luther King, who they recorded dutifully that Hosea Williams gave a speech to a group of four nationals suggesting that the CIA may have been involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King. Those are a couple documents that came out. So those are interesting things that I thought came to light from the new documents that I came across as well, with their reach in terms of who they were monitoring by the late 1960s.
Did you, David, did you see that memo that said that they were bugging McCone's office?
No. Say that again now, Blair. I'm sorry.
Someone had put a listening device in the desk of McCone.
I have not seen that document.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they didn't trust McCone right off the bat.
Of course, he was an outsider.
Yeah. But again, ironically, as I stated earlier, it was in my article, man, once McCone took power, he was every bit of as resistant of any of the reforms that committee had as Dulles. You know, I think he was not siding with the Kennedy side of things at all. I mean,
well, this is part of the problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so now Patrick and I might have a little disagreement on this, but this idea about the unitary executive, that a lot of people, when they become appointed agency heads, they get captured by their own agency professionals. And in fact,
yeah,
talking to an attorney, he briefly served as attorney general. I forget his name now because he's now, I think, he's our ambassador to NATO. But I asked him, how come Trump didn't get control of the bureaucracy? And he says, you only can get down to two or three levels, and before you know it, the agency had to begin touting the talking points of the people that they are governing or in charge of. And what the unitary executive theory is going is like the president has the ability to basically control what his agencies say and do in the executive branch. But I'm not surprised that McCone would have gotten, you know, captured.
Yeah. If you look,
they also kept him out of the loop.
Yes,
potentially right. I think that's probably part of the equation too. Although, I mean, Larry, didn't you have something on was that McCone's diary or something? What you found something a couple of years ago about McCone's movements on November 22nd. Larry Rivera.
He was partying. He was partying, having drinks and dinner that night.
Yeah, there's some suspicious things there that came out.
And every meeting and every...
after he met with Bobby?
The calendar, which is only 83 pages of the year, is missing the other whatever, if you do the math. And most of the pages of November are missing. And they sort of, it's sort of like a roadmap, you know, because additional to that, McCone's papers were released. So we were able to look at the calendar and associate and cross-reference that memo onto that day where he had the meeting with the president, you know, and so on. So it's all detailed in the book as well. You know, it's chapter, 14?
So you're saying he sat down with Bobby Kennedy for like an hour or two, right? And you're saying then he went home or went someplace else and was having
with Roswell Kilpatrick, yeah. Yeah, the guy, the defensive minister Hawk there, who was in charge of armaments. Yeah, yeah. Roswell, those guys were partying into the night that night.
Are you sure they were partying, or were they drinking and trying to figure out what happened?
It says the calendar says having drinks and dinner. So I think that's a little
specific. You know.
I guess you can take that either way, right?
Yeah, I don't think anyone was partying except for...
let's call it celebrating.
I wouldn't even say that. I mean, I don't think McCone would have celebrated the death of the man that appointed him.
Yeah, I mean, that's... Let's return, though, to the conversation we had. What Larry Schnapp, we got two Larrys going here, mentioned about the executive, about putting somebody in charge and maybe they being kind of co-opted. You know, you could see a kind of a modern, you know, not going too much into recent point in time, but we've had Cash Patel and Dan Vigino, did I say his name right? Basically number one, number two in the FBI. These guys were going to go after all these different, chase down all these conspiracy things and stuff and going on. What have they done? Have they followed through on all that? I mean, that some of them might be bogus anyway, but it seems like they've been kind of okay. They got caught up in the bureaucracy. They were wanting to do all, you know, rip through all these things they were going to accomplish. They haven't done anything.
I think a really good source, which somebody alluded to indirectly earlier, was Talbot on the Devil's Chessboard, shows a really good perspective on the generation after generation of intelligence agency relationship with the political structure. And from the point of view of the Pentagon, you've got this lieutenant who had his very fast speedboat during the war cut in half by a Japanese destroyer versus the guy who ran the D-Day invasion. From the Pentagon's point of view of Eisenhower versus who Kennedy was, you know, Kennedy was a snot-nosed kid, as General LeMay made very clear was his opinion.
I would give Patel a few more months. They're probably doing an investigation. And remember, they got really hammered because those Secret Service, the Social Security numbers got released. They're probably going through the files now to make sure that truly innocent people's names are not released. So,
with respect to the JFK assassination files now, right?
I think...
maybe Epstein too, Larry? I mean,
I'm talking about Epstein, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Gabbard is definitely on top of this, but she's also got a lot of things to do. So...
Mm-hmm.
Bobby, I got a text from someone that wasn't directly from Bobby, but it was a close friend that said that he said that she's really busy right now, and you know she's doing the best, but she's really busy. So this is nice. Yeah.
I was gonna say let's take a quick break. Put a pause on this for just a second. Larry Rivera wants to share a couple things, and I know he's on time constraint, so let me. Let me put a pause on this discussion. I'm going to switch to Larry, and then we can switch back so that way Larry can make his appointment. Go ahead, Larry.
All right. How about some extra credit here?
and another thing, I want Larry to announce the upcoming new book that he is in the process of finishing.
Yeah, it's 8 years. From the very first release of the documents in July of 2017. But one of the big discoveries here, and it's why I said extra credit, what are the chances of three individuals in Mexico City on November 22nd, 1963, to become chiefs of station of their own country after the assassination? And how many of these were they, you know, because this is so astronomically impossible, okay, but it happened. three, and if we count William Harvey from the Western Hemisphere division there, who ended up being chief of station in Italy in Rome at a time when the Catholic Church was being sort of arm twisted in the CIA's favor over Cuba, okay? But what are the chances of at least three, in this case I'm going to give you three, employees or agents that were spooks that worked in the Mexico City station that would become chiefs of stations of their own countries? You know what? But what would the probability of that be? Maybe. If anybody can, you know, just comment on that, because we have...
Sounds like it's a high probability based on what you're about to say.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, you mentioned the Lienvoy, the wiretapping operation, and the Liemti, which was the photo surveillance operation going on there in Mexico City. And it might have been where Mexicans were, might have been the grunts, but the agents that were in charge of these operations, and I've been lecturing on this for a while now, were CIA agents, and it was very well organized. They had their monthly reports, and then they had their yearly reports for to renew the operations, you know, and rebudget those operations on an ongoing basis. And so these people were very, very much involved, and the people that ended up being chiefs of stations elsewhere were very much involved in both the wiretapping and the photographic operations there, where we know that Mexico Mystery Man, more than 12 photos of this guy, heavy set, you know, balding, you know, obviously not Lee Oswald, and then where the CIA cannot come up with the tapes that supposedly show Lee Oswald making phone calls to the Soviet embassy from the Cuban consulate and vice versa and whatever. So all this stuff that is going on in Mexico City gets defined, okay, in the sense here where Lee Oswald's passport prohibited him from going to Cuba. And that's why this is one of the most important documents, and I do not see very much progress with others that know a lot about Mexico City as far as the importance of that newly discovered passport of Lee Oswald and what it says and why it had been suppressed for so long. I did a Freedom of Information request to the FBI for the passport after I found them at the North Texas State Repository, who actually took all of the documents from the Dallas Police Department. And fortunately, one of the ones that flew under the radar that was never detected was Lee Oswald's passport, D092526. And if I may, here, I'll take the share, and I'll go right here. Orestes Peña. David knows that I've been talking about Orestes for a long time, and specifically when Juan de Bruce said, went in to see him after the assassination and said, you know, I can get rid of your ass anytime. You will disappear if you do not do what I'm saying. But look at Orestes Peña's passport, and it was renewed. I mean, I don't know if you are looking at coincidences. You know, how coincidental is this, that Orestes Peña and Lee Oswald would renew their passports on the very same day, okay? With Orestes checking in at D092577, only 51 spots removed from Lee's, okay? Because now we have Lee's passport, and now we can connect the dots, and now we can, you know, place that passport into the puzzle here. Okay.
Larry, have you you might want to send the copy of Oswald's passport to Luna's
I sent her everything.
Okay. Did you send it to her counsel or directly just to her staff? Well, how do you send it to her?
I would have to get with you and give you the email address that I use. But yes,
okay. All right. Because has anyone, because confusing thing is, how did he – it says not valid for Cuba travel. And then he goes to the embassy. They would see that on his face.
Now we know that it was suppressed for so many years, and now we know the reason why it was suppressed. And I'll go down a little bit here, but the coincidence here is stark. I mean, it's so incredible. So CD-1307 commissioned document, okay, and that's Orestes Peña, because they investigated Orestes. Why? Because Carlos Bringier called the FBI and said, look, Lee Oswald went into the Havana bar, and he ordered a lemonade, and he was with these other Mexican-looking guys, all right? So you got to talk to Orestes Peña, and that's how Orestes Peña gets dragged into this, you know? So when they investigate Orestes Peña, he turns out to be an informant for Warren the Brew. And when, you know, Orestes starts to say what he knew about Warren the Brew and his relationship with Lee Oswald, and that Lee Oswald was one of the guys, okay, the federal agents and at Customs and ATF and this and that, and they hung around together, had breakfast and coffee and whatever, and Orestes Peña is the witness, all right? But how is it that he and Lee Oswald are at the passport office on the same day? You know what? The probability of that being, you know. So, in my mind, you know, okay, they did
not. Weren't they, like, close in line, like they were one right behind the other?
Well, there's only 51 spots removed from one and the other. So, they had to have been there on the same day. Okay? And here is the proof. Here is June 25th. And this is, see, they did not publish Lee Oswald's passport, D092526, of the same day that Orestes does his. But they did publish the passport application, okay? And if you look at this application, and I'm going straight here for the PDF of my book here that you're looking at, everything looks nice in black and white. You would have never detected that where it said here for occupation, somebody else filled out photographer in red ink.
Oh, look at that.
All right? So, you know, right away I'm seeing, you know, something, you know.
What is that other red ink?
Oh, that's the signature of the processor, the person who received, you know, a 6/24/1963, okay? This is the photo, an excellent photo of Lee Oswald, which checks out with the 1959 passport.
What is that red next to that?
I mean, you're looking at the color, and this is why this has been suppressed for so long. This is these are the countries that he proposed to visit: England, France, Germany, Holland, USSR, Finland, Italy, Poland. Not a single mention of Mexico, okay? Not a or Cuba here. And there's a reason for that, okay? One thing: the FBI had in their possession the passport folder on November the 22nd, 1963. Now, you know. That's incredible foresight here, that they would have this folder on the same day, the same night of the assassination. Okay, here, and this is the contact print, okay, that I found at the North Texas State University repository, and it is an incredibly clear image. I mean, there's just no way that you can refute this here, okay, because not only did we find this, we also found the receipt signed by Warren the Brew, where he receives this on the 26th of November, the next Tuesday, okay? And it's very clear that this is the chain of evidence of custody of the passport ends with Warren the Brew on 26th November, 1963, all right? After that, poof, it's gone. So this is the reason why, because a person who travels to or in the listed countries or areas may be liable for prosecution under section blah, blah, blah. Okay, and at the top, okay, this passport is not, hold on. Okay, not valid for travel to or in communist-controlled portions of China, Korea, Vietnam, or to or in Albania. Okay. Now, what would the American public have said or questioned or whatever had this been published or revealed the weekend of the assassination?
It doesn't say Cuba's bold print.
That's right, because they had to put a special rubber stamp onto it. That's why if you look at Orestes, It's a little off kilter. Okay, mm-hmm. You guys notice that? I'll put it up here again, right here. You see this?
Yeah.
Okay, because the stamp did not make complete contact with the passport. Okay, but Lee's did, and it is an excellent image, okay, of his passport here.
Yeah. Now,
and when we process it and we enhance it, this is the result. Now, I don't know about you guys. This is the other page, 092526, okay? The passport was found not at Roof Payne's Garage. It was found at 1026 North Beckley, okay, at Oak Cliff, where he was renting in the name of O.H. Lee, all right? And this is one of the most incredible documents I've come across, because this is Warren DeBruce signing for both passports. Hello? Am I connecting here? So
wait, you're going too fast. Hold on a second. So, all right, see, DeBruce, this is in the blue, this is him signing?
Yeah, on the right. That's for the old passport.
Hill? Is the first name received Hill?
No, it's right here. Name?
No, on top of that. Received?
Oh, yeah. Hill, yeah.
Ah.
Yeah, because you have a representative of the DPD and you have the FBI. Okay, this is a Dallas Police Department form. And he's going to take over the passports, and this is the evidence, the chain of word ends, the chain of custody here. And it's, it's D092526 in the name of Lee Oswald, date of birth, blah, blah, blah. So
is this in the archives?
Of course not.
Okay.
Of course not. And I'm very disappointed that the people at Mary Farrell, I'm very disappointed, I have to say, that the people at Mary Farrell have not made these available, even though I did send the images and everything, and it's like these don't exist, and other people who have a lot invested in Mexico City, have not realized the importance of this.
Who has possession of the passport?
Warren DeBruce, November 26th.
But now, currently now, when you found it.
Well, when the FBI answered my FOIA request, and they said, pursuant to the JFK Act, that anything related, they did not specify this document, but said anything related has been sent over to the National Archives.
Okay, I'm trying to do, this is for purposes of going forward. You right. have this passport. It's not in the possession of the archives.
No, it's not. Well, I don't know, because now we know.
Well, where did you get it from?
The FBI has, offloaded their responsibility on the passport, but in a global fashion.
Sorry, where did you get the passport? A copy of the passport?
The copies of the passport had been, what happened was, and this is very interesting, because as you can see, the DPD took photos of the passports, okay, mm-hmm. where somebody held them down, okay, as you can see the fingers here, the fingertips,
mm-hmm.
and they did, and what they did, they opened it up, and they took the photo with a 35-millimeter camera, very, very good, extremely good quality images, and then these they were at the Dallas Police Department for many, many years, decades.
Okay, so you're saying these are photographs. Of the passport that was
taken by the Dallas Police Department.
It was given to the FBI, and at that point it disappeared.
No, the FBI took the actual passports.
Right,
the
right.
The photos were taken by the Dallas Police Department.
Correct. I'm just trying to, these are photographs that you got that were in the files of the DPD.
That were transferred to North Texas State University.
The originals.
So Larry, you got them through the Texas Portal History Data.
Yeah. That's right. I posted this on my blog. I have the link and everything. You can follow
it. Okay, so here's the thing. We have evidence of this original. We have evidence it was given to the FBI. It's not currently in the National Archives. This is one of the documents that are missing.
I just wanted to clarify.
Okay, all right.
This one should be in Congress right now. Where is this?
No, you're right. This is one of the records that are outside of the collection. I'm just trying to verify.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Mr. Rivera, I have a question real quick. May I ask the implications of this in relationship to the the Giesling Anderson Brannigan FBI alert rosters that neutralized Mr. Oswald on 10 October 1963, where Brannigan is essentially the head of Soviet Russian intelligence for the FBI, pulled Mr. Oswald's name off of the alert rosters. What is the implication of these documents?
I have no idea. Montenegro, okay. I have no idea. You know, my
yes, sir.
Research has been concentrated, and if I may, I will go since I'm pressed for time, and David wanted me to show the audience, you know, what the book is about. This is the cover, okay, and it's called 21st. Like you, as you can see, the passport is on the front cover, okay? The evidence that this Lee on the left, 1959, and Lee on the right is one and the same person. The evidence that the signatures on the left from the 1959 passport and the one on the right are exactly the same signature, okay, and they check out. Now, the people that are involved here, the reason that these people are on this cover is because all of this is being derived from new information coming out since 2017 that I've had my nose in these things for now 8 years, and the picture comes out as very clear. That Lee Oswald did not go to Mexico City. He was impersonated, and I'm glad that Patrick brought up Dan Hardway a little while ago, because Dan Hardway and Ed Lopez wrote what is known as the Lopez Report, which was first released in 1996, I believe. But there are other versions of the Lopez Report that are not non-redacted, and in the report, Edwin and Dan determined that there was a very, very high probability that Lee had been impersonated. And so from if you go clockwise here from top to left, we have Wynn Scott, okay? And somebody mentioned earlier that Wynn Scott, that the CIA had a propensity of getting, you know, the heads of state, you know, and endearing themselves, you know, and making friends and everything. Well, I can't think of a better relationship here where Lopez Mateos becomes the best man to Wynn Scott for his third wedding in 1962. And we have videos of not only Lopez Mateos, the current president, but the one that came in 1964, Díaz Ordaz, and the one that came in 6 years later, 1970, Luis Echeverria. All of these were henchmen for this guy right here, Wynn Scott. And they're the ones that made the connection as far as the CIA's nexus and the relationship with the CIA and the Mexican government, because the CIA wanted to pressure Mexico into breaking all relations with Cuba, economic, trade, anything that had to do with Cuba. And Lopez Mateos said, there's no way we can do that. We'll have a revolution here, you know? And that's the whole story is in the book. That's part of the wiretap operation. Lee Envoy, this lady right here, okay, despite what the people might think, she was the one running Lee Empty and Lee Envoy. Her name was Charlotte Zerum Bustos. She was raised in Dayton, Ohio. Her entire family, both sides of the family, were involved in the intelligence community and the intelligence business. And she came up as a junior JOTS, junior operations training officer, officer training in that program. And she is the one that ends up chief of station, okay, because she's the one, if you study Bill Simpich, State Secrets, tremendous book, he talks about the twin cables of October. She was the author of those. This is where this whole thing of retroactively trying to implicate Lee Oswald in Mexico City, and she's the one writing the cables. And then right next to her, that's Sylvia Duran. And this is the Sylvia Duran.
If I may interrupt, Mr. Rivera, I'm so glad you used the word retroactive. That there was no evidence before Kennedy was murdered that Oswald was there. I'm so glad you said retroactive.
Right. And this woman right here, Sylvia Duran, who people have never really studied her, okay, believe it or not, this is from the video when she came out on Frontline in 2013, 50th anniversary, and if we have time to see the video, I'm stunned by the proficiency in the English language that she had. And guess what? She only started working at the consulate 3 months before the assassination, before the supposed, I mean, so all of these pieces are falling into place, you know, like this, like Roscoe White starts to work at the VPD, what, 2 months before the assassination. And then this guy right here, David Sanchez Morales, who, oh, my gosh, you know, I've been talking about this guy, but now we have more files on him, you know. And, of course, we've got our passport. And then I was talking about Gutierrez Menoyo. Gutierrez Menoyo took on Che Guevara, you know, when Che Guevara went to see him in the Escambray Mountains, and he said, and Che Guevara said, we want to take over your operation, you know, and Eloy, who had been working from the Escambray, where Castro and Che Guevara were working in the Sierra Maestra, which is west of the east of the Escambray. So they are totally different organizations, but they're working towards the same goal, which is to get rid of Batista. So here comes Che Guevara, and he wants to take over Eloy Gutierrez's column and his operation. And Eloy received him, you know, with a rifle, you know. And he said, I don't like you. I don't agree with any of your communist inclinations, you know. And, you know, that's it. You know, we're not going to join forces, you know. And they end up arriving in Havana 1 week before Fidel Castro, who still had to come from way east to west towards Havana, okay? So then we got Fidel, we got Eloy again, Eloy and William Morgan, a tremendously important character, player in this story. And these three guys were the actual Mexican grunts. I wouldn't say grunts because they were making a lot of money. But this guy is Raymond Herende, okay? And he's also known as Ramon Alvarez Durant. And this guy, believe it or not, okay, at the time he was running the Liemte operation, Liemte, which was a photo surveillance operation that supposedly caught Lealdo, he was making, if you were to translate into today's dollars, he was making almost $70,000 for running this operation, okay? And he answered, you know, via a cutout to this woman up here, okay? Now, this guy here to the right, this is Luis Alberu Soto, and he was the top mole informant for the CIA inside the Cuban embassy in Mexico City, and he's the one that told the CIA everything that was going on there. He would snoop around a desk of other employees. He had access to the diplomatic pouch. He had access to Cubana Airlines. He would go in and collect all the magazines and all everything, and he would hand these over to his handler, Lawrence Barker. Okay, and then this guy, Carlos Jurado del Mar, this guy is one of the only two witnesses, and he comes up with this information 3 years after the assassination, that Sylvia Duran and Lee Oswald had an affair, which is totally false. Okay. And, of course, our celebrating guys here that I already spoke about, John McCone and Roswell, you know, doing their thing on the night of the assassination. Hold on. Here we go. Okay. 7 o'clock. Everybody's watching the news and everything, finding out the situation in Dallas is still fluid, for crying out loud, you know. And president assassinated, and, you know, Gilpatrick for drinks and dinner, okay? So here's a short – this the table of contents, and then I'll pass this over to David. Okay, it's in four parts, Cuban affairs. What the Cuban invasion would have looked like. S.P. Patrick already published this article, so I'm just adding it, you know, but actually it has to be the start of the book because this is what defines everything else. Okay, Eloy Gutierrez Menoyo, we're talking about almost 150 pages on him. Manolo Ray, and Bang One, and he was the chosen one that was he was the one that was supported by Kennedy to, after everything was said and done and Castro was gotten rid of, that he was the one that would lead a post-Castro government. The Peña de Bru War that I've been lecturing on, you know, for years now. Then we shift over to Puerto Rico, and this whole table of contents, this book you know, just comes out as the documents, you know, as I'm looking at the documents and as they are passing in front of my eyes, you know, and as I'm making notes and saving this and saving that, you know, and trying to, you know, create the structure here that, you know, that's coherent, you know. So we have Skewer One. Actually, he was a governor, former governor of Puerto Rico, and a lot of good information. And then Puerto Rico's role in the anti-Castro movement. A lot of these exiles went to live in Puerto Rico, and they were, for example, Jure, J-U-R-E, after Manuel Rey ended MRP, he always went to Puerto Rico after he left Cuba, but, you know, he created Jure and as a response, you know, and try to agglutinate and bring all the factions, all the exile. That's one of the things that that destroyed the Cuban exile movement, that there were so many factions, so many groups, and they couldn't get together and they could not unite, and that was, you know, that was key in this whole thing, that Cuba got lost to Castro. And then, of course, Mexico City, so important. The Liemti surveillance, you're going to find out stuff there that you never knew before. The wiretap operation, I just spoke about Littimal 9, the penetration agent. Silva Duran, 175 pages on her. And Regis Blahut, this is the guy, then the final part is on the CIA, and this is all stuff that is CIA-related. Regis Blahut, he was the guy that worked for the CIA who was in charge of for the HSCA when they were investigating and they had the autopsy photographs, and he was caught rifling through the safe that had JFK's autopsy photographs, and they found his fingerprints and everything all over. And the way that the scandal was handled was, you know, like the CIA said, look, you got a pig on a poke, you know, so forget about this. You know, we're in charge here. But I must say that Blakey, Robert Blakey, tried to stand up to Stansfield Turner on this, and he was, like, overwhelmed, you know. And I think that Blakey has been maligned over the years, you know, but, you know, the more information that's coming out, you know, he tried. You know, for example, when they tried to – when they finally caught up with Ramon Alvarez Durant in Mexico City – oh, and by the way, his wife also worked in the Liemti program, and they actually blackmailed the CIA, and God knows over what, but I would have to say and infer that it might have something to do that they knew that Lee Oswald was not in the Liemti photographs, you know. And but this Alvarez Durant, you know, that I just mentioned, you know, he just, when they tried to interview him in Mexico City, the setup was, and you're not going to believe this, he was in a room and they had electronic equipment between one room and the other, okay, in order, because the and you were talking about Breckinridge, this yeah. is exactly what Breckinridge would have done, okay? So they went to the Del Angel Hotel, which is about a couple of blocks from the embassy, and they have Durant, they have Alvarez, Ramon, who was Raymond Herende, and he's the one that really knows everything, okay? He's the one that ran the Liemti project. So they have him in a room, and they have the electronic equipment in another room, and that's how they interviewed him. They did not interview him face-to-face, all right? So there you go. That's how paranoid they were about what Raymond Alvarez Durant had to say about this. The other guy, when they went to see him, he was so scared that he wouldn't answer the phone. I mean, I'm talking about Luis Alberto Soto, Littleman 9. When they finally caught up with him, you know, the CIA went and they put a piece of scotch tape on his door, you know, to make sure that they knew that he was there, you know. I mean, some really crazy, you know, spook stuff, you know. And then, of course, our good friend, you know, David Sanchez Morales, the CIA's one-man gang. Charlotte, Sherry Zerin Bustos, you know, if you read the material, it'll say Bustos Vilella, you know, she should have never dropped her maiden name. It was crazy, you know, how at a certain point they actually changed her last name, and which, you know, offered the ability for her to get lost, okay, in the shuffle here. Alan Dulles, his cryptonym was Asham, the McCone calendar. And of course, the Scorzani connection. You know, if you read Gaines and Alberelli, you have to consider some of that stuff. And
well, I was one of real quick full disclosure. I was one of Abarelli's researchers going back to 2015. So
well, you know what I'm talking about.
I was with him in the development of that book. You know,
yeah,
so.
good. Well, you know that's important research. You know, and you know it's got to be there. That's all I got.
Brilliant.
Well, thank you, Larry. And that book will be out hopefully by November.
I'm finishing bibliographies right now.
Okay, perfect. Well, that's another reason to come to the conference so you can pick up a copy. Also, speaking of, the idea of the conference this year is obviously we're looking at the documents. And from what David Denton said a while ago in his presentation, also what Larry's talking about, this is information that, you know, this is what's going to make up the heart of the conference this year. I know that I want to go back. Let me see here. Bob had his hand up earlier before we made a switch.
Dave, can I interject on that a minute?
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
While we're live here, Larry, Dave and I talk about having any actual panel discussion. We'd definitely like to have you on that, okay? So you're officially invited, both Larry Schnapp and Larry Rivera.
Oh, boy, two Larrys on one panel.
Yeah. I just want to make that clear that, you know, that's some of the central stuff that we're going to be talking about. You mentioned Morales, too, Larry, before we go. I mean, I've seen that document about Morales as the one-man gang. It actually says there's some that Morales was involved in miscellaneous activities that cannot be discussed here, even on the document.
You know, I estimate that there's got to be at least 2,000 pages on Morales that got destroyed. We only have the 63-page document that came out a couple of years ago. You know, now this the La Cubra incident, you know, of 1960.
Where did you get that number from?
Just an estimate. Just an estimate.
Yeah, I've come across a document. It was probably in the file that you sent me, Larry. Where there's actually a document coming out of Morales where it says these pages have been sanitized.
That's right.
It's amidst the fact that they've gotten rid of these pages.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me.
When the ARB was looking for records, like we got obviously evidence that the Secret Service destroyed files. We got evidence that some of Oswald's military records were destroyed. Was there any documentation about Morales documents being destroyed?
Well, actually, not only were they destroyed, they were sequestered right after the La Cubra incident when he has to leave Cuba, you know, in October 1960.
I'm saying when the ARB was looking for documents, do we have
No. But before that, the CIA had sequestered. They said that's what they did. They sequestered a lot of documents. Now, you know, if those were shredded after that, we don't know. But we know that the CIA did take those files.
I'm looking for evidence. I'll take a look at the final report. I just want to see what they said about his. I'm not questioning records destroyed. I want to again.
Right.
This is part of like the Federal Records Act. And I just want to see if the ARB, like, asked for his records and they were told, oh, they've been destroyed.
Okay. I'll text you if you want to talk about the other stuff later on.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, on the passport stuff?
Yeah. Email me.
Hey, Larry Schnapp, I can I've got that document where it actually has that statement about being sanitized. I think I could send that to you, Larry.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, there's actual on the paper. We have sanitized the file.
I sent stuff to her, the counsel to the task force. So, you know, directly. So, and he then follows up with witnesses and stuff.
Well, let me tell you something about Morales, and maybe people don't really understand how powerful he was. He reported to the Joint Chiefs, okay? Now, how important could that be, you know, for Morales? And this is new stuff that has come out. I mean, it's just mind-blowing, you know.
He was a go-to guy, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think the nexus between I see Morales and Harvey as the two, if there were people who implemented this operation, you got to look at those two guys.
And Roselli.
Okay, I put up on the screen what David was just talking about. Okay, documents dated 1954, 1975, copy or bio, sanitized for the HSCA, and then on the right, documents removed, copies of sanitized documents.
Okay, yeah. Is there a RIP number for this?
Yes. Yeah, that's the, I'll get that for you.
Okay, yeah. I think that when Harvey left, Harvey kept meeting with Roselli, and it's possible that Roselli was sending messages back and forth.
Okay.
Yeah, I've actually talked about this. There is a document that was released in 2017, which is the CIA's chronicle of their relationship with John Roselli. It goes through a step-by-step, you know, we did this, we were connected with Roselli. And in 1962, when Harvey takes over as his operational case officer, whatever, we don't know what happened to Roselli after that.
He became Harvey's best friend.
Yeah, that's the exact quote. On the document, we're not sure what happened after 1962.
I think they were meeting in person a lot instead of, you know, Harvey did not like to leave a paper trail.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I would think that's very possible. Yeah.
May I comment on the genius of William King Harvey for a moment? I find it egregiously fascinating in the most perverse sense that William King Harvey seemingly is the main liaison with the National Security Agency with his Zero Rifle Staff D operations, and yet he's the top suspect with so many researchers, including, I'm sure, you know, several gentlemen here in this meeting today, in the murder of the President of the United States of America. And we constantly, going all the way back to the Warren Commission, get this excuse that we cannot see files on Mr. Harvey because of national security. I mean, I think that's just absolutely genius that, so many of his operations may have been hidden within the NSA's wiretap operations. I mean, God damn, I can't think of a better guy to pick to murder the president if he wanted to cover up his activities, you know? Anyways.
And we're trying to get his travel records from the fall of 63.
That is right. So important. We did a FOIA here at Albany Central College on him 4 or 5 years ago and got 400 pages back on Harvey. And there was a lot of stuff released on Harvey in 2017. But those travel records, I mean, what was Harvey doing in the fall of 1963? That is the million-dollar question, Larry Snap. If you could come up with something that could illuminate that. Well, you know, he's obviously in Rome, right? Then he's supposed to be in Rome, but was he? I mean, that's the real question.
You know, I think something is telling me in the back of my head that he met with Roselli in June or something in Washington, but I could be wrong. It could be December.
Well, that's correct. He met with Roselli in June, and I should note that Sam Papich, who was the FBI-CIA liaison, had him under surveillance and actually told right. William King Harvey, do you know who you're meeting with?
Yes.
I got a question for David Denton. David, who is all going to be on that panel? I know you just mentioned a bunch of them, but who's going to be on that panel with Larry Rivera and Larry Schnapp? Are you going
right
to be on?
Yeah, I mean, it's still fluid, but Larry, myself, and Dave Knight, we were kind of thinking we were being a part of that, but that's not etched in stone, JV.
The reason I'm asking is because just the influence and the words that you guys have been using in this last 2 to 3 hours has been very, very instrumental in getting people, especially me, because I'm very interested in this, but I think that these people would be excellent in a panel. And is the gentleman Montenegro, is that right?
Oh, Montenegro, yes, sir.
Wow. Can you be down there?
I'd love to be down there. If I had an invite, an official invite, I'd definitely go down, and I'd definitely pay my way, too. I'd love to be on a panel to talk about some of this information, or at least, spitball questions from the audience, That'd be great. That'd be awesome.
Well, that's the fun part. It's the spitballing, you have your presentation, and then the spitballing is where you really get the interesting stuff.
I should note that I've been working on a long-form essay, which may turn into a book, on Jerome Fox, who was a man that spoke with James Wilcock in the Japanese station on November 23, 1963, where, Fox said, hey, Mr. Oswald is one of our guys. I've been looking at his background extensively for the past 4 years, but I just don't have a platform to post any other information, simply because I want to make this very clear. I cannot make a claim in the affirmative that Jerome Fox did what I think he did, and there's a legal problem right there where I may get in trouble with not only the CIA, Army Intel, but the State Department claiming that one of their employees handled Mr. Oswald while he was in Japan.
I spoke to Larry Hancock recently because his book didn't really mention Wilcox that much, and if at all, and he doesn't find much merit in that story.
Absolutely. And I would agree with Mr. Hancock 100%. I agree with Larry that there's not much, merit, I think is a proper word, in the Wilcox story. But the fact that Mr. Wilcox spoke to Jerome Fox and Mr. Fox alleges that he, says that Mr. Oswald was, and I believe the direct quote was, one of my guys, is very revealing because of Jerome Fox's job in 1959. And I won't go in. Well, Jerome Fox worked for the International Organizations Division of Cord Meyer, specifically the Office of Records and Research. And there was a subcommittee within ORR called the Office of Scientific Intelligence, of which the commander was Tom Karamassinis. And then the Office of Scientific Intelligence had another subgroup called, get this, Factory Marking Staff. And that's what Jerome Fox was the commander of in 1959. He ran the factory marking staff for all of Asia. And I looked up the CIA's Strategic Intelligence Review Boards from 1978. According to their official histories, the factory marking staff had a job to infiltrate Chinese and Russian industrial factories and steal technical data and bring it back through rat line capabilities, so human intelligence capabilities, rat lines. So the fact that Jerome Fox was the commander of a CIA operation to infiltrate Soviet and Chinese factories is very revealing about his background. And like I said, I've done a it's about a 300-page report that I've written. I just don't have a platform to publish it on yet.
So that's Jerome with a J, right?
Correct. And unfortunately, he's not referenced as Jerome Fox in official House Select Committee documents. They call him Jerry. But there is a 201 file that was released, I think, back in 2021 or 2022, where he's called Jerome E. Fox. But even then, inside of internal memoranda, they call him Jerry Fox, which is very funny because, it's difficult to find any CIA documents where he's not referred to as Jerry, So anyways, I found it very interesting real quick, if I may, that the man that replaced James Jesus Angleton in the counterintelligence staff, a man by the name of George Kolaris, he used to be Jerry Fox's boss. In 1959? Wow. I don't know what to make of that, but I sure as hell get a kick out of it,
There's a document that was released in March, 104-102-91-10000. It's a personnel file of Jerome Fox.
That's right. I've seen it.
In February 77. Oh, you saw that?
That's right. I think on page like 182 of that report, it actually states that George Collares was his boss in Vietnam while he's training the South Vietnamese police force, and of all things, electronic intelligence and wiretapping. Very fascinating character, Jerome Fox.
Hmm. What page did you say that was?
I think it's page 201, but don't quote me on that, you know? Like I said, I'm still trying to find a platform for some of this information. I actually had a meeting on January 21st of this year with Bill Simpich and Major Newman showing them some of this information, and they were just completely dumbfounded. They were like, I think Major Newman said something to the effect of, how the hell did we miss this guy? Which I thought was an appropriate question for John Newman to ask himself, considering he used to be the former executive liaison to the director of the NSA. But, you know, then again, we all make mistakes. So, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. They say he is a steady, conscientious worker. His main weakness is in organization and presenting the results of his work.
Right. He was anal retentive to no end. In fact, so much that most of his supervisors thought that it was redundant, you know, because he wouldn't just have one operation when he went after a target. He'd have like five or six ops all overlapping on each other whenever he went after an industrial target. So he was a bit of a hard ass, you know. I knew a couple of guys like that when I was in the Army a few years ago.
Wow, they don't have a very good – he's got a lot of marginal ratings here.
Right. Like I said, his supervisors really did not like him because he was just so anal retentive that he was redundant to a point to where it annoyed them, you know. Not very good if you want to cover up stuff, you know what I mean?
Our techniques and methods, analysts and report, okay. Identification specialist.
That's right.
What does that do?
Within strategic defense intelligence, if you're an identification specialist, you know, essentially you'd be handling forward operatives and receiving all of their reports. You know, so that's what it would be within ORR, Office of Records and Research, under the Office of Scientific Intelligence. You know, this is all, you know, heavy, you know, above the brow, you know, paper pushing type stuff. You know, I mean, essentially he was analyzing forward reports from operatives in the field, you know, stay behind men, you know, Gladio types, you know, people that were actually infiltrating these factories, which is what I believe Mr. Oswald may have been doing, working for factory marking staff, you know. Which is fascinating because if I may go off on a tangent with Mr. Oswald's dealings allegedly with Kolstikov in the Mexico City station, which I don't believe Mr. Oswald was there, it is interesting that Kolstikov is identified by Tenet Bagley as being a communications warfare officer that provided secure comms for Soviet ambassadors overseas. And it just so happens that Mr. Oswald infiltrated a radio factory.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know what to make of that other than I agree with Mr. Rivera that Mr. Oswald was not present in the embassy on the days that they said he was there. So it just seems like it's a canard that leads nowhere. But, you know, take it for what it's worth.
Post, you know, what's interesting, and I'm sure this is what happened with Oswald. He's got a he goes to a basic orientation course, and it says – it partially deals with Marxist theory, the history of socialism and communism, activities outside the U.S. I mean, they really debriefed them, so that could be why Oswald sounds so conversant.
Absolutely. I would agree that, at least from the viewpoint of the agency or perhaps Marine Corps counterintelligence, because, you know, according to, if I may, real quick, I know that Bill Simpich and I have butt heads on this in the past, and certainly Larry Hancock and I, you know, really butt heads on this, but... And I don't blame them. But quite a few people believe that Mr. Oswald's military records are being held up by ONI. I think that's wrong, because according to Professor Scott and his report to the AARB back in 1997, he said that the chief of Marine Corps G2, counterintelligence, so that's Marine Corps counterintelligence, which was not under ONI at that time, actually oversaw the release of Mr. Oswald when he put in his hardship discharge for his mama. I think he said his mama, injured her head. A box of candies fell on her head, and the Marine Corps let him go within like 48 hours of his discharge request, which is insane, but there it is. That's fascinating. I find that very intriguing that Marine Corps counterintelligence actually releases Mr. Oswald from active service. You know, that would imply that, you know, he's a Marine Corps counterintelligence human intelligence agent, at least by my bearings. But, you know, once again, take that for what it's worth. You know, unfortunately, the military liaison to the AARB, a man by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Ray, essentially stonewalled Professor Scott back in 1997. He never responded to him, which is, you know, disturbing, but there it is.
All right. Well, I tell you what. What you want to say? Add something there, Larry.
I was asked to identify the three agents in Mexico City. I can give you one of them, and very obviously, actually, he was chief of station of three different countries. David Atlee Phillips, after he left Mexico, the Dominican Republic in 1965, 2 years later in Brazil, and I think 3 years later in Venezuela, in Caracas. The other two, it's in the book.
All right, perfect. And I'm looking forward to that book coming out for this November. And we're pushing what the little over 3 hour mark.
Yeah.
I gotta reel it in here, guys. But let me open it up here. If anybody wants to make comments, questions, something we didn't get to earlier, before we bring the meeting to a close today.
David, may I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is just for any of the gentlemen that were chatting previously, and it refers to a name that Larry Rivera brought up a while back. What can anybody tell me about Marshall Carter?
Who wants to field that one?
Marshall Sylvester Carter was the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency under John McCone, and effectively was Richard Helms' main liaison with the DCI. After he was removed as the deputy director of the CIA, General Carter later became the director of the NSA. And unfortunately, we have none of General Carter's records from his NSA tenure. But that's essentially who he is. He was a general in the United States Army. And he'd actually been one of the advisors to the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the creation of the United States Army Green Berets, going back to, I believe, 1952 and 1953 under Colonel Aaron Blank. So he had a long history of Carter working with the special operations community, going back to at least the early 1950s.
Can I share a story with you? Around 1992, a gentleman by the name of Jim Southwood surfaced. This is at the point where his 30-year secrecy oath had expired. And he contacted a researcher in my area that I had worked with for many years at Tetro and shared the story, the fact that in August, September of 1962, he was an analyst with an intelligence group, I'm not sure which number, in South Korea. And his superior, I think it was Major Dominic Riley, calls him into his office and tells him that I need you to pull the card, some information on Lee Harvey Oswald, Harvey Lee Oswald, George de Moenshield, and then a couple of innocuous things, Teutonic Knights, Polish fighter pilots. But Riley shares the names of the two gentlemen who contacted him directly to have this information pulled. One was General Earl Wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was Deputy Director of the CIA, Marshall Carter. The information that Mr. Southwood was to, pull from the files and analyze was then to be sent directly to the 112th Intelligence Group in Dallas, Texas.
Here's the disturbing thing about that. One, we know for a fact that Dick Russell is convinced, and I've spoken to him on this issue, and he hasn't budged, And I believe Martin Lee, another researcher that's looked at the far right in the American South, he wrote a book called The Beast Reawakens about the Ku Klux Klan working with the special forces in the American South spying on Martin Luther King. But it's very disturbing what you're implying there, because South Korean intelligence, which effectively had the name KCIA, Korean CIA, which is, you know, that's what they were called in that time period. It's very disturbing because allegedly one of their forward operatives was spying on Mr. Oswald, and that was a captain in the United States Army by the name of Richard Case Nagel. And allegedly Nagel was sheep-dipped into something called Forward Operations Intelligence, and that was a joint venture between the Korean CIA and our United States Army that had a global capacity. And I don't know what to make of General Wheeler's name being mentioned in that, other than the fact that in 1962 and 63, General Earl Wheeler was, in fact, a part of the anti-Castro coordinating task forces within the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You know, so, you know, Wheeler was one of these men that was working directly with Cyrus Vance. Cyrus Vance's deputy, a man by the name of Calafino, Joseph Calafino. And I believe Calafino's deputy in 1963 was Alexander Haig, of all people, who would later, you know, be prominent with Richard Nixon and his dealings with China. So, you know, I really wouldn't know what to make of that.
You're aware of the fact that Joseph Calafino and Alexander Haig were both overseeing a contingency plan that had already been initiated months before the assassination, and RFK's liaison between that group and himself was John Nolan. You aware of that name?
That's correct. I know it's very disturbing to say this, but you know, Calafino received a report from Colonel Samuel Cale through Alexander Haig, where Haig essentially was told by Calafino, look, we don't know what to do with these Brigade 2506 guys, so just ship their asses to Vietnam and you know, let the Saigon Station deal with them, which is essentially what happened. You know, Theodore Shackley and Dave Morales, you know, pulled a lot of these anti-Castro guys and stuck them in the Phoenix program, and quite a few of them actually died in Vietnam conducting hunter-killer operations. So, you know, was that a way to, like, liquidate them unofficially? I don't know, you know.
Well, to me, the most important question that needs to be asked is why 14 months before the assassination is an Army general and the deputy director of the CIA having files pulled on Lee Harvey Oswald to be submitted to the 112th Intelligence Group, who then are very visible, you know, in Dallas, in Dealey Plaza, you know, the day of the assassination.
Real quick, I think that's a question you should front to Dan Hardway, because Dan Hardway, back during the House Select Committee, actually interviewed several of the commanders that were involved in the 112th. And they said under no uncertain terms, twice a month, and this is what they told Hardway, twice a month, the 112th was debriefing 4th U.S. Army Operations Group and the CIA concerning all CIA domestic operations from, get this, Flagstaff, Arizona, Mexico City, Oklahoma City, all the way to Miami, Florida. So that was the scope of 4th U.S. Army Operations Group. It was a domestic Army intelligence operation that was spying not only on far-left activists, but get this, far-right personalities that were infiltrating military installations and stealing weaponry. Now, I know, you know, several researchers, including Jim DiEugenio, who once again, you know, he and I have butt heads on this issue in the past, entertained the idea that there were several weapon seizures out of Fort Hood, and that there was an ATF agent by the name of Frank Ellsworth and a 316th security agent by the name of Edward Coyle that were actually tracking Alpha 66 and Omega 7 operatives stealing weapons out of Fort Hood. And that the operative, get this, the informant that was giving them the information was a man by the name of O. Lee Sarvey. So, you know, I don't know what to make of any of that information other than the fact that After the 22nd of November 1963, all of the 316 files on O. Lee Harvey disappear. You know, so they're completely gone. You know, so we have no clue, really, according to Dan Hardway, what the hell the 112th and the 316th were doing with these O. Lee Harvey files. You know.
Well, the other interesting thing about the 112th, and this seems almost like a scripted, what would you call it, a psyop,
right.
The whole assassination event is the fact that that day, after Oswald is arrested, I guess the liaison between the Dallas Police Department and the 112th Intelligence Group, Don Stringfellow, writes a memo that he sends to the 112th that day stating that Oswald has confessed to murdering the president and he had defected to Cuba. Both of those are bullshit. But he's already putting that in a memo, you know, to an intelligence group. So what's going
Not only that, but Stringfellow is involved in transmitting that information to MacDill Air Force Base in Florida to Strike Fighter Command. Essentially, and I agree with Bill Simpich on this, Bill Simpich and I both agree that the reason why Stringfellow transmitted that damn report is because he wanted the fighter command at MacDill Air Force Base to bomb Cuba and start a third world war, which I realize that's an explosive conclusion to draw, no pun intended, but I think these assholes really wanted to, you know, use the murder of President Kennedy as a false flag to start a damn war, you know?
The whole story of Gary Ween and Audie Murphy and John Tower, the whole false flag, fake assassination attempt, you know, where does that all fit in? And, you know, so a lot of unanswered questions, to say the least.
Well, I'll just say this much. It has to be appreciated that William King Harvey was a station chief in Italy, and that was ground zero for Operation Gladio, which was infamous for staging false flag attacks and blaming them on leftists. You know, so take that for what it's worth.
Well, Senator Tower was certainly shocked by what happened, and one gets the feeling that he had pre-knowledge that this was going down. He was maybe one of a few of the select people that were aware that this was an operation that then went south when it was kind of infiltrated by people who actually did kill the president. And then everybody was forced to fold their tents, so to speak.
Well, we have to appreciate that John Tower's brother-in-law back in the mid-60s was a gun runner that was working with the anti-Castro effort in Mexico. That was a man by the name of Samuel Cummings. Sam Cummings was John Tower's brother-in-law at one point, you know? And Cummings was involved in arming the CIA's efforts in Guatemala, Haiti, and in Cuba. So, you know, Tower may have known through his brother-in-law, you know, what the hell was going on in Mexico and just never told anybody, you know?
If I may share one more quick story, and that's what we call the story of Ron. And this is a gentleman that contacted Oliver Stone in the 90s after JFK had come out. Are you familiar with this?
Yes, sir, I am.
and I wish somebody would sit down with Oliver Stone. I'm sure this gentleman who he called Ron has passed away. His son who he shared the story with has passed away. I'd love to hear more details beyond what Stone told his biographer who did that coffee table book. You know, talking about the fact that this gentleman who was 19 years old at the time was in a sequestered group of 10 people for 3 months in an operation under the DDP of the CIA, which was Richard Helms, as he called it, a paramilitary psyop. And you know, how do you get more clear than that as far as the fact that military intelligence and the CIA were directly involved with whatever happened in Dealey Plaza. And yet you never hear anybody discussing the story of this guy that, you know, contacted Stone or what the whole connection with the CIA's paramilitary division was all about. But it seems if the guy's telling the truth, then why wouldn't he be? You know, this is something that should really be looked into. I've never heard anybody even discuss it.
Well, once again, I applaud you for bringing up the wrong narrative because, you know, that's something that overlaps, in my opinion, and, you know, I would ask anybody here to correct me on this. Charles Tracy Barnes allegedly was the commander of the Domestic Operations Contacts Division of the CIA in 1963. If you look at his CV, Barnes in 1952 is the commander of all paramilitary operations for the National Security Council 5412-2 Committee, which oversaw covert action on the NSC level. So that's above the CIA. You know, I find it very disturbing that the head of the Domestic Operations Division contact office, Barnes, actually oversaw all paramilitary operations on a global level at one point. You know, once again, you know, just something to consider. Yeah. You know?
Well, there's certainly a lot of connections between military intelligence and what went on that day, and finally,
yes,
the
sir.
Story of Steve Osborne, the gentleman who found out was met this guy purely by accident, who was in Dealey Plaza that day, and had come up in a production vehicle from Fort Hood, Texas, and they videotaped the actual motorcade coming through Dealey Plaza with state-of-the-art for 1963 video production equipment, not film, but video.
Right.
You know,
that's right.
And this is, again, connected with military intelligence as well as and I tend to believe the story of Shauna Willis about her father, who was
once again, Dan Hardway would be the person to ask those questions about, because he actually, along with Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Ray, actually interviewed James Powell, I believe, who said he was a part of a photographic reconnaissance team that was not tasked with securing the motorcade. They were photographing people in the crowd. Now, what the hell is that all about, you know? What was their mission? Who were they spying on, you know? Anyway.
Well, there was a guy besides James Powell who just happens to photograph the sixth-floor window 30 seconds after the fact.
That's right.
But there was another gentleman whose name escapes me who's photographing the bus Oswald's supposedly on, and then he makes his way to the Texas Theater to photograph Oswald being arrested, you know?
Yeah.
So you have military intelligence with pre-knowledge documenting all of these events for whatever reason. We can only guess. But you know,
I have a guess as to what they're doing. In all likelihood, they're procuring photographs so they can doctor film later on. You know, that's something that photographic reconnaissance teams do in these PSYOP operations. You know, they create a pool of photographs so later on they can doctor composites, which, you know, certainly we have problems with everything from the Zapruder film, the Orville Nix film, to the Atkins photographs, you know. So I'm of the opinion that all that footage and all those photographs have been doctored at one point or another, you know. So I don't think I'm alone in saying that, you know.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right about that. You're absolutely right about that. Well, thank you for your insight.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Hey, Ron, you've got your hand up. Did you want to add something here or ask a question?
Hi. Sorry. Thanks for the great webinar today. Larry's book, can you pre-order that on Amazon or?
Larry, you're on mute. There you go.
We're working on it. You know, it's going to have to be divided. It's 1,050 pages so far. It's going to have to be divided up two or three volumes.
Okay.
To include the copies of the documents that I've looked at so that the person, you know, can make their own interpretation, maybe something different from myself. And that's why it's so many pages. So we're dealing with that at this moment. The bibliography is about 75% done.
Okay. Do you have a website where I can pre-order? Is it just?
You can actually read some of the because some of the stuff some of the chapters are actually blog posts that I have developed further, and it's in my blog. I dropped it in there in the chat. If you go a little further up, I did the passports, and then you can just back out of there, you know, and just look at the entire blog structure. It starts at in 2017.
Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. A lot of the stuff is the same, but, you know, obviously in the book it's a lot more detailed and developed.
All right.
You do whatever you want without worrying about grammar and stuff like that, you know, but not in the book.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Ron. Well, we've got about we're gonna have to wrap up here in about 10 minutes, so we got time for maybe one or two more comments, and then we're gonna bring the meeting to a close. But we will be back between. I don't have the exact date yet, but it's going to be in July. We'll have our next meeting, and just to throw it out there, we're looking probably the 12th or 19th, be on a Saturday, just like, you know, all of our other meetings. But anyway, we'll get to more information on that at prodigyfk.com. Would anybody else like to make another comment or ask a question of anybody that they spoke to?
David, may I address a question that somebody posted in the chat?
Yeah, absolutely, Rick. Go ahead. And it's good to have you here today. I appreciate you showing up.
No, always find these very fascinating sessions. Somebody had posted the question, if it was a false flag, why didn't we end up going to war? And I think the fact that the false flag would have been connected with a fake with an assassination attempt, but certainly not the actual murder of the president. And I think when that happened, I think that everything that came after the fact, specifically the events at Bethesda Naval Hospital, were all, under the control of Bobby Kennedy, who was concerned that his brother's death was going to be used for that very catalyst to drive us into Cuba. The very things that the people who were putting together this so-called false flag, and I don't believe Bobby Kennedy had anything to do with that, but that, you know, they didn't trust Bobby Kennedy to handle the situation in Cuba properly, and so they decided to create this this false flag situation. And I think everything that happened at Bethesda was to basically control the narrative, and Bobby Kennedy ended up supporting, at the end of the day, the lone gunman from behind. And I think that's what happened out of all this. If Kennedy hadn't been killed, but they could establish through all the documentation that we just talked about, the films, the photographs, and everything else, that an attempt had definitely been made on the president, then I don't think there's anything that President Kennedy or Bobby Kennedy could have done to stop, you know, us from going into Cuba if that was directly connected to, you know, between Oswald and Castro. So, you know, everything went south, but...
If I may respond to that for a minute, and I pray I'm not monopolizing everybody's time. Allegedly, General Godfrey McHugh, who was the military aide to President Kennedy on Air Force One that day, allegedly he, and I think Douglas Horn can confirm or deny this, allegedly LBJ through Air Force Two was trying to get in contact with General Curtis LeMay for about 45 minutes to an hour after the assassination. And that's that infamous Air Force Two transcript where the pilot of Air Force Two is like reporting, grandmother, grandmother, grandmother. And that's General Curtis LeMay's code name through the Collins-Rockwell radio transcripts for Air Force One, grandmother. That was his code name. So if you can believe General Godfrey McHugh, he actually was, you know, trying to intercede on behalf of LBJ, the brand new president, in order to stop this thermonuclear first strike. But you'd have to talk to Doug Horn on that one. Yeah. You know?
Well, another interesting thing that came out of those Air Force One tapes, when the Clifton family finally, after Clifton's death, is the fact there's the fairy tale about Jackie Kennedy talking to Dr. Berkeley about where should the autopsy be done. And she states Bethesda because Jack was a Navy man.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. What we end up hearing finally on the tapes is the fact that you've got General Clifton and George Berkeley contacting I think it was General Heaton at Walter Reed, informing him we're bringing the body to you for a formal autopsy, so forth and so on, only then to have the White House Situation Room contact these guys on Air Force One. So wait a minute. Plans have already been made by Tazewell Shepard, the president's naval aide, to bring the president's body to Bethesda. So that's another name, along with Marshall Carter, that no one ever talks about, Tazewell Shepard. We hear about the photographer, Robert Knudsen, who took photographs of the president's body at a pre-examination. And who does Knudsen work under at the White House? Tazewell Shepard. So that's the reason why he was at Bethesda that night. But once again, I think that contingency group plan that was set up for, you know, diplomats of the United States that were killed overseas that might be connected to Castro or Cuba, you know, would then all of a sudden the body would be taken to a military setting, the autopsy would be controlled, and the narrative would be controlled. And that same kind of operation that was set up for other situations that, you know, theoretically could happen were implemented with President Kennedy's body that day, which explains all of the goings-on at Bethesda that night.
Well, I tell you what, I'm gonna go ahead and bring our meeting to a close, but I wanna do some quick shout outs here. I wanna say thank you to everybody that shared today, everybody that asked questions. That's why we're here. This is what we do. We're here to explore not only the new documents but also the case as a whole. There's a lot to unpack. I mean, can we get it done in a 3 or 4 hour? Hell, we've gone as late as 6 or 7 hours on one of our meetings here. But that's why we do what we do. It's not just about waiting until conference time. It's why we do the monthly meetings. And again, I apologize with college. It was kind of hard to concentrate on that. There's only so many hours in the day, like we've talked about before. But yeah, like I say, it's great to have you all here again. Monty, I want to say you've got a plethora of information in your mind. It was great hearing you. It was great having you in the meeting today.
David, can I talk?
Yeah, go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, I just want to give a shout to Monty. I hope David and you guys will invite him to Dallas.
I hope he's not an off.
he's a good guy.
Full disclosure. I have, in fact, worked with the intelligence agencies in Afghanistan on my first combat tour, but I was a communications specialist in the field artillery corps, so I received their reports in order to shoot at enemy operatives that were shooting at me. But other than that, I haven't been in contact with them for about, you know, 12 years now. So, of course, I was young and stupid. I was 17 when I joined the Army. I'm 33 now, so that ought to give you some idea of how long it's been, you know?
I know him by voice, and I know he worked with Hank and with Leslie he's very knowledgeable, and I'd like to meet him.
Absolutely. I'll see if I can make the meeting, even if I don't get an official invite. I'll see if I can be out there anyways. And believe you me, everybody, this is not the first time that I've been accused of being an asset or an op. It's the 100th time I've heard that, yeah?
Well, I tell you what, the conference this year in November, I mean, we put on a great conference. I think I got to say we definitely want to make sure that we're doing the case and the community justice, and I think we do that every year, and it only gets better every year. You know, with everybody's support coming out, whether you're in person, and yes, we want to have your asses in the seats.
Hey, you just gotta keep the kooks out of the room. That's all.
Yeah, we got to do that. But also having everybody on Zoom, not only during the conference, but here, you know, with our journey. You know, we can't do it without you guys. I mean, with this, and I know the research community has gotten a bad name, but when it comes to actually, you know, doing what we do, and the key players that we have involved, and the key researchers and speakers. I can't thank you guys enough on behalf of myself, Brian Edwards, and Casey Quinlan. You know, Pride of JFK gives us the vehicle to, you know, to host these events and bring everybody together. And I know when we do the Dallas conference with the JFK Historical Group, you know, it's more than just, you know, we don't throw it together at the last minute, unlike some of my journey meetings. We plan on it all year long to bring something to the public and to the community.
Impossible. I have to talk to you right now because I don't. I,
Hang on just a sec. Okay. So anyway, yeah, I want to say that the schedule, speaker bios, I know those are going to be coming out here pretty soon. You'll find that information at JFKHistoricalGroup.com and also ProjectJFK.com. And, you know, if you guys want to send out an email or you have a question, you'll have some comments. Be sure to send those to ProjectJFK at Yahoo.com. Again, the website is ProjectJFK.com, and these replays happen usually within 24 hours. They get posted up on the website and also on our YouTube channel. So if you're seeing us as the replay, make sure you hit that like and subscribe button so that way you know when the new ones are coming out. And if you have questions after watching the video, post it in the comments. And I want to say to all of our speakers that want to go through the comments and answer those, it's not a bad thing to do. It's, I mean, there's people that maybe can't make it to our live meeting, so they catch us on YouTube. You know, we'd love to have them here live as well, but if you can answer a question and reach out to the people that are watching the videos, that would be very helpful because, you know, they're asking and we're here to give out the information. So go ahead, Larry.
Speaking of videos, let me play this short clip of Sylvia Duran and notice how good her English is.
Okay, right? Go ahead, Larry.
Real quick.
But that's impossible. I have to go to Cuba right now because I only have a permission of 3 or 4 days in Mexico City, so I have to go. I thought that in a moment or he will be crying because his eyes, he was very excited, he was very red, and his eyes is like with the, well, with bright, shining, like he was in tears. So, and he didn't want to understand. And so I called the consul Asquith.
Duran says Oswald lost his temper with Consul Asquith.
Then Asquith says, listen, get out. Get out. And he went to the door that it was locked. He opened and said, get out. And if I see you again, if you come again, I'm going to kick you out.
Now, she is describing the Oswald that is not Arlie Oswald. She was describing the short guy, blonde, who got very, very upset, and also later on, Tony Summers, when he caught up with her in Washington, I believe 78 or 79, he showed her a copy of the video of Lee Oswald being interviewed by the, it was a WDSU, the TV station in New Orleans after that fracas, you know. And And when she saw that video, she said, that's not the guy I saw, I met at the embassy. You know, this guy, you know, is eloquent. He talks, you know, very intelligently and everything, you know. So she was not able to identify Lee Oswald from that video that Anthony Summers showed her. You can read it in Conspiracy. So my thing here, and it's, I'm moving forward, you know, more towards the idea that she might have been a recruit, you know, for the CIA. You know, the fact that she starts working there only 2 months, 3 months before the assassination. Look at her fluency in English. You know, she talks like somebody who actually went to school in the U.S., you know, who was educated in the U.S. and learned English. She lived in Mexico City. There was no use for her to talk English in Mexico City, and especially with the position that she had before she went and took that position of processing visas when her friend Carmen Olagarri was killed in an automobile accident in July of 1963. So, you know, the conundrum here, you know, and also additional to finish on, Sylvia, I had some people in Mexico City trying to track her down about 8 years ago, and their response to me was that she was, from what they could discern, was she was protected by the government. So I'll just leave you guys with that on Sylvia Duran.
Well, thank you, Larry. And, hey, you just sparked a thought in my head. I didn't mention this earlier, but I'm going to mention it now before we leave. Just to let everybody know that I've been posting, and this was done just a couple months ago, but I've been posting past conference videos on the website and on the YouTube channel. The only JFK only Illinois conference from 2022 has been posted in its entirety, each episode. You will also This is on the past conference tab up here at ProdigyFK.com and also on our YouTube channel. But the other conferences that have been posted so far is the JFK Dallas November 17th through 20th, 2022 conference. The other one that is done is also the Memphis, Tennessee conference from April 13th through the 15th of 2023. The Dallas conferences for 2023 is being done as we speak. That should be up here, I'm hoping, within the next few days, a week at the most. And then I'm gonna go ahead and get the Dallas 2024 conference. Now, that one will not be posted on YouTube, but that will be available for purchase on flash drive or digital download at the conference. And the last conference I'll be working on prior to November will be the one that I hosted at Johnson County Community College here in Overland Park, Kansas. That will be also going up. So, you know, if you guys, you know, attended, or if you didn't get a chance to, that is your opportunity to go on and enjoy it in its entirety for free, minus the Dallas 2024 conference. And, you know, it's to build awareness, it's to build momentum for the conference, and also to get the subscribers to come on, because the more subscribers we have, the more we get noticed. So if you click on the video, make sure that you do subscribe. Make sure you hit a like button. That way we can grow our numbers on that. We've got a lot of great information. I mean, we're talking hundreds of hours of videos to peruse through. So it's a great resource. You know, that's what Prodigy FK's vision was originally, was to become the silo of information to bring all the other silos together and kind of have a one-stop shop. That was another reason why we brought in the JFK Index to house it under the umbrella of Project JFK CSI Dallas. So I want to say again, you know, thank you again for, you know, attending today. Thank you to those who are going to watch this replay on YouTube and on the website. Again, look for the email that'll be coming out hopefully here in the next couple of weeks that will announce the July journey meeting. And also stay posted to the fact of the JFK Historical Group website that will have, and also Project JFK, will have the information for the conference coming up in November. And be sure to get your tickets early. It has a potential of selling out this year. So we want to make sure that you get in and get your tickets bought, whether it's in person or online. And don't forget that we only have a certain amount of block of hotel rooms. And once that discount goes away, then you're paying full price, and nobody wants to pay full price for a hotel room these days. So be sure to, go and get that sign up done. And again, remember, your conference ticket does not include your hotel room, so you need to pay for your hotel room separately. That's why the link is on there for the hotel, and then you can get your link or you can get your tickets bought through the purchase tickets tab. Real quick, Ron, what you got for me?
Hi, David. I was wondering if you could have Max Good on. He did that documentary on Ruth Payne.
Well, I tell you what, I will take that under advisement. I need some contact information for him. I know I don't have it, so get with me on that, and then we'll see what we can do. But
okay. All right. Yeah. Thank you. I'll email you that.
I appreciate that.
And we'll do that later this week.
All right. Well, thank you again, everybody.
Thank you.
We're going to bring this to a close, and I will see you again next month. So this is David Knight with Project JFK CSI Dallas and the host of the Journey Meeting. Have a great day. Oh, hold on. No, okay. We're good.